It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You better cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
And here we are. Hey now. Thanks for being here today on the big program. We're going to get that compressor fixed one of these days. I swear it. Welcome to the big program tonight on the big program. Pennsylvania State Rep Dave Lebdansky going to be talking about the severance tax that has passed the House. We'll see if it gets through the Senate and where that's going to go. And also in the third hour, AFL-CIO Secretary Treasurer Liz Schuler will be here to talk about the big rally on Saturday, which we are going to be in attendance, Jake. I hope it will be a large crowd, a couple hundred thousand people, or if we were to use Beckian terms, a few hundred million.
I'm very much looking forward to it. I hope it certainly has an impact coming into the election. Working people need to focus on what's important.
I'm looking forward to our Sunday show, because we do a weekend program as well. I'm looking forward to the Sunday show where we can come back and say we were elbow to elbow with 600 million people. You know, like the Beck people do. You know, there were 1,600 million people there. There were 4,400 million people there. We were elbow to elbow, smushed in like ants. But Jesus was there and made us all better. Kind of makes you wonder. I got to tell you, I'm increasingly amazed at how people watch Fox News and then are not paying attention to when anything bad happens to a Republican, they always put a D next to his name. Or when they have one of these rallies, half the crowd is in parkas and half the crowd are in bikinis. And they're, you know, they just kind of, it's a bunch of nonsense. And I think it is a bunch of nonsense. It's a great opportunity. It's a great opportunity, Jake, to go back and say, you know what? I think we're going to stick it to you a little bit. We're going to get one last shot to really, and we're going to take it.
It's a little bit like what those four healthcare providers did. 2 days before it went into effect, they said, well, you know, if we're going to be forced to cover children, guess what? We're not going to carry children's coverage at all. I understand their motives behind it, but to punish children because you want to throw a tantrum, I mean, quite frankly, Rick, I think politically that was stupid on their part.
But what McDonald's is saying is they're saying, look, and here's from their official memo, it would be economically prohibitive for our carrier to continue offering the mini med plan unless it got an exemption from the requirement of 80 to 85% premium benefits. Think about that. 15%, 20%. is not enough for their overhead costs. I wonder what kind of profit they're taking in. Because think about this for a second. The people that are being covered are younger people. These are, you know, most of the people who work for McDonald's are younger people. They're not using health care. And, of course, McDonald's didn't disclose what their plan's current medical loss ratio is. And I'm curious, you know, exactly what is it? Having to drop the current mini-med offering would represent a huge disruption in our 29,500 participants, said McDonald's memo, which was reviewed by the Wall Street Journal. They said it would deny our people this current benefit that positively impacts their lives and protects their health. Wait a second. You're talking about a plan that covers almost nothing, in my opinion. If they get sick, I mean really sick, it doesn't appear to cover anything. So what's the point in having it? And are these people now really, I mean, these quote-unquote mini-med plans, is this any health security, Jake?
It's a poor excuse.
To me, these people are uninsured.
McDonald can say, hey, come work for us. We provide benefits. We'll give you health care.
What health care, though? I mean, that's not what we think of when people have health care. When I think of somebody with health care, I think of somebody who, if they're diagnosed with cancer, they're not going to lose their, even with today's health care, they're going to be treated. This stuff, this plan doesn't do any of that. The way this is written, there's nothing there. This is if, you know, you need stitches. Yeah, maybe it'll cover a couple of pennies of it, but it's still going to cost you out of pocket.
Well, isn't this a situation where, you know, they're afraid that maybe we're discovering how bad some of their coverage was? This is, I believe you said it correctly, the last hurrah for these people. I mean, this health care reform was very minor. And even this minor reform is shining light in corners that we haven't seen before. We probably, as bad as it is, Rick, we probably don't know how totally bad it is.
And this is why I'm glad this stuff is popping up. I'm glad to hear that these companies that, you know, I would have never thought of, McDonald's, Home Depot, Disney, CVS, Staples, Blockbuster, all of these big companies offer their employees these miserable little mini healthcare plans that don't appear to cover much of anything. And I looked at this quote a spokeswoman for McDonald's said. She said, quote, the company's, well, she said they won't be able to offer insurance if they don't get a waiver. The company's chief people officer for the U.S., Steve Russell, said McDonald's will continue to be committed to provide competitive pay and benefits. Competitive to what? I mean, is this what we want? I don't think so. And this is another one of those examples of where we really need to look at the health insurance industry even more, especially now that we have something on the table. And I'm telling you right now, we cannot go back on November 2nd. We just listening to how bad some of these plans are makes me go, we need to strengthen what little is in that bill, and we need to do it sooner as opposed to later. So this November should be a referendum on, you didn't do enough. You got to go farther. And the polls bear that out, Jake.
Yes.
Poll after poll says, you know, people aren't happy with it because it didn't go far enough. That is the reality. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and talk about this a little more. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this.
Rick Smith Show. You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
President Obama is urging working people nationwide to vote November 2nd to prevent a return to Republican economics that have devastated working families.
In the period when they were in power, from 2001 to 2009, job growth was slower than it had been in any decade since World War II. Between 2001 and 2009, middle class incomes fell by 5%.
Union workers and their supporters across Europe protested economic austerity measures by European governments on Wednesday. The 60-million-member European Trade Union Confederation called the protests. AFL-CIO International Representative Penny Schantz participated in the Brussels protest along with some 100,000 workers.
There's 23 million unemployed in Europe. There are millions of European citizens who've been made vulnerable and insecure, and there's a growing massive social tension across Europe. So to cope with the situation, the only response Europe's governments have been able to come up with is basically to adopt these austerity measures, which could lead Europe into a recession and result in even more unemployment. I think workers would agree in Europe and in America that we didn't cause the crisis. And the bill has to be paid by banks and not by workers. We reject the austerity plans in Europe and the cuts in wages and pensions, the insecurity and unemployment among young people, and deregulation of labor standards.
Seasonal retail hiring is expected to be up this year, Jesse Russell reports.
It isn't steady work, but it could give some of the chronic unemployed in the country brief relief. Human resources consulting firm Challenger Gray & Christmas released a report this week that suggests 2 months of consecutive retail sales gains could signal to retailers they may need to increase their seasonal hiring. 2008 saw a 22-year low in hiring, with employers only adding 384,000 seasonal jobs. 2009 was slightly better, with more than 500,000 jobs. The firm also said retail layoff announcements have plummeted by 65% in comparison to the same time last year. Some announcements by retailers this week seem to verify the firm's predictions. Toys R Us, JCPenney, Best Buy, and Macy's have all said they will hire a combined 169,000 seasonal workers.
One of the largest employers in Wisconsin could be headed for a strike. Workers at Kohler Company in Kohler, Wisconsin, have authorized the negotiating committee to call for a strike if a contract agreement can't be reached before the current contract expires on Friday. Nearly 2,300 of the company's employees are represented by the UAW. This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Hello, I'm David Philman, Executive Director of AFSCME, Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. A union of over 1.4 million strong and growing, AFSCME is gaining improvements in the workplace all across America. And right here in the Commonwealth, more than 95,000 AFSCME members make Pennsylvania happen. Highways, libraries, hospitals, parks, offices, prisons, classrooms, museums, courtrooms. You'll find AFSCME members at work in all these places and many more.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
Today's AFSCME members take on public service jobs as diverse as they are, not for the recognition, but for a better Pennsylvania. For more information, please visit our website at AFSCME13.org. Labor is changing. So is your labor union. We are AFSCME.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show.
Yeah, fire it up. That's right. I hope that woke you up on the road tonight. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. You know, in talking about this, these mini-med insurance plans, are these people really insured? I mean, if you have something that doesn't cover the big things, I mean, a cap of $2,000 a year? In the medical field, what exactly would you get for $2,000? Maybe an aspirin? Maybe, you know, maybe the ugly nurse to bring it to you in a little cup. I don't know. That's not a lot of money, Jake.
That's pretty pitiful, I must admit.
And this is a failure of this health care bill. Because as we know, most of the people who make the minimum wage are somewhere, their family somewhere near poverty. And in 2014, people with an income of 133% of poverty would be eligible for Medicaid. Right now, poverty's at almost $11,000. Also in 2014, people at 133 to 400% of poverty would be eligible for subsidized health insurance. Premiums would be capped at 2% of income for those at the lowest end and 9.5% for people at the highest end. So even if you made $100,000 a year, you'd be paying about $9,500 a year for health care. That, to me, is not unreasonable. But, you know, I got to tell you, I'm increasingly shocked at some of the scams that I've seen, some of the, you know, the funny language that you need to be a lawyer to figure out. We need, and what bothers me is that the people at the bottom who are consistently ripped off, oh, we've got health care for you until you actually need it. You just keep giving us money every week, and we'll keep walking to the bank. To me, these plans, they look like a ripoff to me.
Well, it reminds you of the health savings accounts. It's another situation. They're fine as long as you don't have to use it. My comment on this.
Well, health savings accounts are great. I think if your health savings account are the greatest invention if you're one of Pat Toomey's buddies and you need a place to hide some of your money and you need a place to keep stashing money and be able to collect interest tax-free,
yes.
That's fantastic. If you're somebody who's working for a living, making 10 bucks an hour, putting 2% or 3% in, that's not health care money.
I think the health care system, the average American, I think it's worse than the average American understands. And I do believe this pledge that the Republicans are coming up with. One of them is that we're going to go after health care reform, and we're just going to cut it to ribbons.
Yeah,
well, when you look at the numbers, there was a poll last week, AP poll, and surprisingly, Rick, or not surprisingly to some of us, when you look deeper into why they oppose it, exactly what you said, 40% of them said we opposed it because it wasn't strong enough. 20% said, no, we don't think the government should be involved. I think the Republicans are dramatically, either for political reasons or they're not quite adept at understanding the nuances of the reaction of the American people, but there's a large percentage out there that oppose it because it wasn't good enough. And I think long term, if the Republicans misjudge that or misuse it politically, long term, it's somewhere along the line, we haven't seen it yet, and we might not see it this election, but somewhere along the line, that issue is going to come back and haunt the Republican Party. I guarantee it.
I mean, you look at these plans, and I got to be honest, as I'm reading through the article, I didn't realize that there were these limited, at the bottom end, plans. I knew that there were plans, the catastrophic plans, that were relatively cheap and were high deductible, high copay stuff, but protected you on the top end, where if you did you did have cancer, or you did have a heart attack, or you had something major that happened, it would kick in and it would get you treatment. Probably going to bankrupt you, but it's still going to get you treated. But this kind of a thing, I never thought something like this existed. And what it does is it takes advantage of people on the very bottom. And you go through the list of stuff of how the poor get ripped off at every turn. We'll cash a check for you. Payday lending. You bring us a check and we'll write you money and we won't cash it for 2 weeks and we'll charge you 300% interest. Or this thing with Montel Williams. I'm going, Montel, what's wrong with you? You could have $1,000. All you need is $800 a month income. Montel, come on, buddy. Why are you helping rip people off?
He needs a job, Rick.
Well, we all need jobs.
Obviously, he must. I thought the same thing, to be honest. I always had a lot of respect for him. I thought he had a decent show. He seemed to be a genuine human being. But, yeah, I... I saw those commercials for the lenders that he works for.
And it's always the people at the bottom who are getting the short end of the stick.
The people that he's being a shill for are shady at best.
When I was a kid, we used to get these insurance agents who would come around. And you know, they would try and sell you these whole life insurance policies because they knew and they would play on the parents' fear. Oh, well, this is a tough neighborhood. You know, you may end up getting a bullet through one of your kids' heads. And, you know, people bought them. And then you realize that you're paying like 10 bucks a month forever for like 500 bucks.
And you know what? They knew that it was a gold mine. I can remember my dad had a painting business, and I was out on a job, and I think I had, what is the age? Is it 18? They come after you? And we were out on a job, and I was up in the ladder, and all of a sudden these two guys with suits show up. And it was my parents' insurance man and his boss. And they didn't want to talk to my father. They wanted to talk about me because they wanted to get me the first day I was eligible. Because they knew long-term it was a gold mine.
And that's the kind of stuff that happens to poor people. And, you know, I don't want to say that they're uneducated or that they don't understand, but they get taken advantage of time and time again because they... But here's my problem. You look at her whole operation, and you understand, as a senator, she is going to be in the pocket of corporate America. She's running her business on a system set up with independent contractors. She doesn't really have any employees. They're all, hey, we're going to come and we're going to do this little event and, you know, pay a couple shillings. There, you get hurt, you're off on your own. Is that the kind of country we want? I don't think so. And I don't think she's the kind of senator that we want. I look at a lot of these folks. These are not the kind of people we want making law in this country, especially labor law, which I think desperately, desperately needs to be reformed. We're going to take a quick break right here. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back with your call. Stick around.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Some members of Congress complain that they have a really tough job. Also, they say their hard work is not appreciated by the public and that they're really not paid enough. Well, not to worry, Congress peoples, for I have the perfect cure for your job grievances. Become coal miners for a while. Talk about hard work, bad conditions, poor pay, and unappreciative bosses. Then there's that irritating thing about being killed on the job. You might remember that 29 miners were killed in April in a horrific explosion inside West Virginia's Upper Big Branch mine, owned by Massey Energy. Massey, a $2 billion a year giant, is notorious for putting its workers down in inexcusably unsafe coal mines. Last year, it was cited for more than 500 safety violations. And it had just received two more citations at Upper Big Branch on the very day of the murderous explosion. Such killings happen because coal corporations have used their campaign cash and lobbyists to make mine safety rules a cruel joke. After Massey's April explosion, however, public outrage prodded Congress to write tougher rules and put some teeth in safety enforcement. Great. But wait. Senate Republicans are now sitting down on the job, refusing to move this life and death legislation to passage. Their shameful work stoppage is meant to stall any action until after the November elections. Wealthy mine owners, you see, are pouring money into this year's Republican efforts to win control of the Senate in exchange for assurances that a GOP Senate would water down or kill these vitally needed safety reforms. This is Jim Hightower saying, what a disgrace. And they wonder why the public has no respect for them. I say that every soft-handed, pampered Congress critter who opposes these safety reforms should be sent to work in the mines for at least 2 years.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow. Now available wherever books are sold.
Old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one? Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211. You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well. Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211. How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave? Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair, sir.
Officially in love with Michelle Bachman, even if she's batshit crazy. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Foreclosures have accounted for 24% of all residential sales in the second quarter of this year, according to the latest data from Reality Track. A total of 248,534 U.S. properties in some stage of foreclosure, default, scheduled auction, or bank repossession sold to third parties in the second quarter. While this represents an increase of nearly 5% from the previous year, the figures are down 20% from the same time last year. You look at this and you go, that's an awful lot of numbers. That's a big, big number, but hopefully we're stopping some of this. James Sacasino says, while foreclosure sales increased in the second quarter, non-foreclosure sales increased even more, spurred on by the home buyer tax credit that expired during the quarter. So look, you know, there were some policies that the administration put forth to try and stop the landslide. When this took off, when the economy was collapsing, people were losing their jobs, their homes weren't far behind. Most people, Jake, are upside down on their mortgages right now. Their incomes have been stagnant and declining, and they were and in a lot of cases sold a bill of goods that, unfortunately, when bad things hit, they couldn't afford.
If I can remind you, at the height of all this economic downturn, in a 2-year period, about 1 million Americans lost their home. 1 million. Huge.
And you look at this and you go, you know, this is what we were told, you know, be part of the ownership society. This is you're going to be your wealth creating vehicle. And people bought these houses because they wanted part of the American dream. I mean, I remember when I bought my first house. I mean, I just absolutely remember that pride that, you know, I have achieved the American dream. You know, that ghetto kid, that kid that grew up on the streets, I now have a place of my own. And I look back, at it, and I go, you know, what was I thinking? You know, my ex-wife and I at the time were making really great money. We took on a mortgage that was well within our means. And then we end up getting a divorce, and I end up having to pay the mortgage. And I was still making really good money, but it became a struggle. And I was able to pay it. It wasn't that I wasn't. But had I lost the job I had, then I would have obviously would have been foreclosed on. And this is what happens, that life happens to people. But when you have a massive economic collapse like we had, when the Bush Depression hit, a lot of people who are in those situations, Jake, they fell through the cracks.
And then you factor in the health care issue, which was on top of it, and you can see, it's easy to see the horrible situation as far as foreclosures. But you're right about owning your own property. It gives you pride. It gives you pride. It gives you a sense of now you're part of the community. I mean, I've told you many times, one thing that prevents me from moving on to another home, my grandfather built that property. That's part of my history, part of my heritage. And I feel a connection to that. And I literally would feel, I would have pains of conscience if I sold that out of my family.
And, you know, I got to be honest. You know, I look at, you know, the house I have now. I go, you know, I don't, the bank owns part of it. I own a good chunk of it. The bank owns part of it. And in that house, the bank owned most of. But even back then, in the mid-90s, there were rules. You had to have a down payment. You had to have you had to show you had some wealth. This is where, by allowing the laws and the regulators to just go away, and, you know, just to say we need to deregulate this because, you know, of course, you know, banks and consumers, they're sophisticated. No, who's sophisticated is the guy figuring out how to con you out of your wallet. That's what's sophisticated. And when we took off the constraints and we said, okay, go, 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 this is what happens. And it's not that people were irresponsible. It's not that they were lazy. It's not that they were stupid, like the right wants you to believe. It's that people honestly believed that given what they were in at that moment, they could afford what they were being given. And I cannot tell you how many times friends of mine came back and said, well, the bank's willing to lend it to me. They think I can afford it. And wanting to pull my hair out, going,
they don't care. They didn't care because they got the nice little bonus up front. And then if you went belly up, the toxic mortgages they sold in the secondary market. It was a win-win.
It's, you know, it's even worse than that. I don't know anybody who bought a house and has the mortgage from the company that they filled out the paperwork with. The first thing that happens when you fill out that paperwork is they sell that mortgage off to somebody else, and they sell it. I remember that house I bought in 95. That house was sold and resold at least four times that I can remember. And it was a pain in the neck every time I had to hunt down who the new owner of the mortgage was. I say we need to go back to the way it used to be. Home ownership is part of the American dream. But you should have to have at least some equity put into it. It used to be 20%. You'd have 20% down.
Now you're hearkening back, and you talked about you're hearkening back to a time when the banks were concerned about the community surrounding area. Unfortunately, that's gone by the wayside.
And I say the bank that writes you the loan has to keep it. They have to service it. To me, that makes good sense. So that if you do run into trouble, you can go to the bank and say, you know what, I'm having a little trouble. I don't want to foreclose. Can we work something out? Because I know my grandparents. You know, they told me a couple of times they ran into a little trouble. They were able to go down to the bank, work something out, and were able to make it through a couple of rough patches. And that's what we're in right now. We're in a rough patch. We're going to come out of this. I know a lot of people like to, you know, think the sky's falling, but the economy's going to turn around. And there will be a better day. But what we have to do is we have to work through it. And together. And that's why I think, you know, if you had smaller community banks, you had more localization, I think we'd be much better off. And then we wouldn't see that 1 in 28 U.S. kids have parents in prison. I mean, stop and think about this. You want to talk about our budget? You want to talk about the money that we waste? Stop and think about how much money we spend incarcerating people. The U.S. has an exceptionally high rate of incarceration, causing economic damage not only to the people behind the bars, but their children and taxpayers as a whole, according to this new study. The study from the Pew Research Center's Economic Mobility Project, released Tuesday, reports that the U.S. prison population has more than quadrupled since 1980, from 500,000 people we had locked up back then to 2.3 million people. We have the highest incarceration rate in the world, not just in the industrialized world, in the world. We beat out Russia. We beat out South Africa. We are, you want to say, hey, we're number one? We're number one at locking people up. And this means that more than one in every 100 people is in prison today. And the cost to states now exceeds $50 billion a year. So think about this. One out of every $15. One out of every $15 of money generated in this country goes to prisons. And it's become a growth industry. I remember the fights back when Clinton was passing three strikes and you're out. I remember the fights. And I remember hearing people back then say, whoa, 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 whoa. This is going to be a horrible thing. Because we haven't really defined what is. Locking people up is not the answer. And we went to this privatized prison system. They built these big, big profit centers. And look what's going on. Now, look, I'm not saying we don't lock up violent offenders. I'm not saying we don't lock people up who are true criminals. But the reality is, folks, we're spending one out of every $15 on locking people up. If we were to take some of that money, here's an idea. Take a little bit of that money. Put it into education so that, well, I don't know, maybe we have an educated populace that wants to stay out of prison, that has hope, has opportunity, has the chance for a job.
No, you're forgetting something. A lot of these kids, because they didn't have jobs, took the alternative, especially, you grow up poor like you did. If the job wasn't there, what did you do? Well, you went to a life of crime all too often.
Oh, I sure do remember. According to the report, a family with an incarcerated parent earns on average 22% less the year after the incarceration than it did before. And children with parents in prison are significantly likelier to be expelled from school than others. 23% of the students with jailed parents are expelled, and compared to 4% of the general population. Nothing good comes of it. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back with your calls. 1-888-520. Rick, 1-888-520-7425.
I got a picture in my pocket of the lucky one. I'll announce the winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat. It is my business hat. I'm up till 1 a.m. I must tell you that. I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better.
Some politicians say the unemployed won't look for work until their benefits run out.
Ed has been laid off from his pipe fitting job for over 18 months.
I'm here to tell you, being out of work is no fun. It sets you back in life. Benefits provide for less than half your wages. There's no health care, and your family suffers. To those politicians who think anybody would rather be collecting unemployment than working, I say come join us. We won't forget on Election Day.
This Labor Day message brought to you by the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, Richard Bloomingdale President, Frank Snyder, Secretary Treasurer.
Workers in the late 1930s began exerting their recently guaranteed right to organize and join unions. Millions of workers flocked to join the labor organization of their choosing to collectively bargain for better wages, hours, and working conditions. Factory, mill, and mine owners, not eager to embrace the changes, fought vehemently to deny workers their rights. As company tactics grew more heavy-handed and brutal, the workers' organizing methods changed. Sit-down strikes became a way for workers to demand their rights and to force management to listen. With a wave of a handkerchief, the tip of a hat, workers would shut down their machines, lay down their hammer, and sit down. Workers at the Hershey Chocolate Factory in Hershey, Pennsylvania, seeking to reduce the 60-hour-long work week, decided to form a union. Initially, an agreement was reached, but as the economy took a downturn, the company willfully violated the agreement by laying off the most senior workers, those who just happened to be the most ardent union supporters. The workers voted to strike the very next day. At 11 a.m. on April 2, 1937, a red handkerchief was waved and the workers began their first sit-down strike in Pennsylvania's history. The company reacted by forming the Loyal Workers Club. These These strikebreakers consisted of hired thugs from New York City and local farmers, dairy producers, and shopkeepers who were dependent on the factory. On April 6, Hershey...
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Diane Petrick of the Daily Item writes, public pool users beware. Beware, that's the message of former State Department of Health pool inspector Sherry Tremeter of Lower Augusta Township. The department's five sanitarians, the name it uses for inspectors of indoor and outdoor pools and hot tubs at hotels, gyms, private clubs, and schools, were all dismissed on Friday, she said. While State Health Department spokeswoman Holly Senior said the agency's environmental health specialists will take over the pool inspections, Tremeter contends that they aren't trained for it. So basically, they maybe send someone like me out who, you know, the most I know about a pool is you jump in, you swim around. So maybe that's the qualification to be a pool inspector. The article goes on to say, meanwhile, dismissing the sanitarians will save the state approximately $275,000, Senior said. They were among 15 employees furloughed as demanded by Governor Ed Reddell's budget. The wages that these people earned were between $35,000 and $40,000 per year. Now, remember, these are the people who go into all of those places, you know, the gyms, the hotels, and they make sure that those pools, the chemicals are right. I had a girlfriend back in high school, Jake. Her father went to one of those, you know, those yuppie kind of health spas. I forget, Victani, I think it was called at the time. And he went to go in the hot tub, and they had the chemicals just totally screwed up. And he ended up burning his lungs, and it was in the hospital for about a month, couldn't work anymore. His life was completely changed. And so when I read this, I immediately, you know, popped back to being 17 years old and remembering that story. And this is not good stuff, folks. Not good at all. We're going to save a couple of bucks on the front end, but nowhere near what it could cost us. Let's go to the phone lines. We got Mike on line one. How are we doing tonight, Mike?
Oh, pretty good, Rick. I was listening to you discussing the housing issue and how they played that game. Excuse me.
Yep.
But the house builders were brought in on that same con. They quit building reasonable houses.
Yep.
And started building mini mansions. So if you wanted to go out and buy a reasonable house, a three-bedroom, bath and a half, they weren't available. You had to go out and buy a 2,500-square-foot
yep.
house with four bedrooms, three baths, blah, 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 blah. And then the banks turned around and convinced everybody, you can afford this. Well, yeah. Hey, the experts say you can afford it, and we can't find the others, you know?
Yep, and that's pretty much what I said, because I had friends who, you know, making about the same amount I was making, $65,000-$70,000 a year, buying $300,000-$400,000 homes, and I'm going, how can you afford that? And they'd say, well, you know, the bank said we can.
Yep, and the political subdivision, the township, played into that.
Because they get higher taxes.
Yep, and they looked the other way and let them build houses that were too big without enhancing sewage and water infrastructure, things like that, stormwater rent runoff, all those things.
Yep.
And it goes on yet today. There are a lot of housing that can be made available to people that are alternatives type housing, but they will not allow them to be built.
Well, they would argue, and now I have a couple of friends who work in the home building industry, and they would tell you that the consumer wants these McMansions. That's what, you know, people want to live in big houses. They don't want to be cramped into these little affordable box houses.
Well, the consumer has to want them because there are no other choices.
And again, there's the perfect, that's the response back.
Right. I mean, when there are no other choices, I don't know if you've ever been out to the state park, seen some of the cabins of yurts that they've built. That kind of housing could be very useful in a lot of applications and provide lots of people, same thing with modular housing. And they have virtually zoned out, in many cases, anything that deviates from the mini mansion, template. And that's not by mistake. These political leaders, and I use that term in some disgust, are purely looking at their own egos and looking at bringing in as much tax as they can so they have more money to build more power. And I think that they've gotten us into a situation I'm not sure we can get out of.
Well, I got to tell you, I'm not the doomsday, and I can't believe I'm saying this. I'm not that doomsday. I think we can. I think we can work our way out of this. I think the country's been in worse situations, and I think we will find our way out of it. It's a matter of you know, hitting rock bottom, and I don't think we've hit that yet.
I agree with you there. I don't think we've hit rock bottom yet, and I think that's going to be a very painful slide, and I think it's coming sooner than later. But one of the things that have to keep in mind when you compare other times in history with now is the demographic was quite different. During the Great Depression, for instance, about 70% of the nation's population was still agrarian. They were on the farm.
They were producers.
They were producers. They could, they if they didn't get a paycheck, it didn't mean they didn't start, that they would starve.
Right.
We're not that way anymore.
Yeah, and I've had that conversation with a couple of people that have said the kind of the same thing, that we need to go back to local. We need to, you know, I think I had a caller on the weekend who said, you know, start seeing people line their driveway with tires and start putting tomato plants in tires. To start planting your own food and being semi-self-sufficient.
If you put tires on your driveway and plant tomatoes in them, most of the townships nowadays will come by and write you a citation.
Well, this is true as well.
Yeah, I mean, it really is a vicious cycle, but that's exactly what people need to be able to do. They need to be able to have some choices and once again start to return agriculture and infrastructure and jobs that can be performed locally. And if we don't do that pretty soon, we're going to have a real problem.
Yeah, what's frustrating to me is everything seems to be so partisan. There's no one who, it doesn't seem to be there's really anyone who's willing to step up. And I thought Obama tried, and he, I think he's still trying, because he keeps reaching out to Republicans, and he keeps trying, but they're just slapping his head away every chance they get.
I believe that Barack Obama is probably one of the most well-intentioned men to ever hold the office of the presidency. And I think the one thing that he failed to anticipate was just how vile the Republicans are. They don't care about this country at this point. They want to destroy him. And if they have to destroy the country and a large part of the population in it to do that, so be it.
Yeah, because their constituents aren't going to suffer.
No, they're not. And they know that. They know that. They know their constituents are not going to suffer at all unless they go and push it into the abyss. And then all bets are off.
And then those walls around the gated communities aren't going to be high enough.
No, they are not. And what amazes me is none of the political people seem to, or if they don't express anyway, that level of seriousness in the current economy and in the country. And I think that's a very bad mistake.
I agree with you, but I don't think the Tea Party movement, I don't think these extremists that are popping up right now, I don't think they're the answer. I really don't.
I'm not sure they're extremists. I mean, I think they're somewhat buffoons,
okay,
if you ask me. If you go ask one, well, what do we need to do? Well, we need to make smaller government. Why? Why? Okay, let's do away with the police department. Oh, no, we can't do that. Why? Well, that'll be smaller government. They have thought nothing through.
Well, they're reactionary. And
that's right.
But I still say they're off on the fringe. They're off the reservation for the mainstream. Mike, I got to take a break right here.
All right.
I appreciate the call. As always, great stuff. Thanks so much, Mike.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Always great stuff there. Time for a break? 30 seconds. Okay. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Love to get email from my listeners, and we're gonna go through a couple of those a little later on. Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Again, You know, every time I talk to Mike, it's always something great.
He always brings what he brought up is a great question. These right wingers asked him, less government, okay? You tell me where.
No, that's what I've been saying. What takes its place? We're right back after this. Stick around.
I'll drink my beer in a tavern, sing a little bit of these working men.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. President Obama is urging working people nationwide to vote November 2nd to prevent a return to Republican economics that have devastated working families.
In the period when they were in power, from 2001 to 2009, job growth was slower than it had been in any decade since World War II. Between 2001 and 2009, middle-class incomes fell by 5%.
Union workers and their supporters across Europe protested economic austerity measures by European governments on Wednesday. The 60-million-member European Trade Union Confederation called the protests. AFL-CIO International Representative Penny Schantz participated in the Brussels protest along with some 100,000 workers.
There's 23 million unemployed in Europe. There are millions of European citizens who've been made vulnerable and insecure, and there's a growing massive social tension across Europe. So to cope with the situation, the only response Europe's governments have been able to come up with is basically to adopt these austerity measures, which could lead Europe into a recession and result in even more unemployment. I think workers would agree in Europe and in America that we didn't cause the crisis. And the bill has to be paid by banks and not by workers. We reject the austerity plans in Europe and the cuts in wages and pensions, the insecurity and unemployment among young people, and deregulation of labor standards.
Seasonal retail hiring is expected to be up this year, Jesse Russell reports.
It isn't steady work, but it could give some of the chronic unemployed in the country brief relief. Human resources consulting firm Challenger Gray & Christmas released a report this week that suggests 2 months of consecutive retail sales gains could signal to retailers they may need to increase their seasonal hiring. 2008 saw a 22-year low in hiring, with employers only adding 384,000 seasonal jobs. 2009 was slightly better, with more than 500,000 jobs. The firm also said retail layoff announcements have plummeted by 65% in comparison to the same time last year. Some announcements by retailers this week seem to verify the firm's predictions. Toys R Us, JCPenney, Best Buy, and Macy's have all said they will hire a combined 169,000 seasonal workers.
One of the largest employers in Wisconsin could be headed for a strike. Workers at Kohler Company in Kohler, Wisconsin, have authorized the negotiating committee to call for a strike if a contract agreement can't be reached before the current contract expires on Friday. Nearly 2,300 of the company's employees are represented by the UAW. This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. The other night, they finally passed something on the severance tax that we've been calling for the longest time. It may actually be a reality, and who knows? A deadline may actually be kept. To talk a little bit about the bill is State Representative Dave Levdansky. He represents Allegheny and Washington counties. Dave, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Rick.
You know, I gotta tell you, I was happy. I was surprised. This seems to me to be a step in the right direction.
Oh, yes, it absolutely is. I mean, especially if you're interested in making sure that our communities that are impacted by the drilling, and the importance of adequate funding for environment and conservation efforts. It's a good thing. This is good for Pennsylvania. It really is, and I've been working for about a year and a half on this, so I'm pleased with the action in the House, and now we move on to the Senate and try to engage the Senate in working out an acceptable compromise.
Right. So right now, let's talk about the agreement that you guys passed. What are the basic points?
Basic points is it would establish a severance tax on the extraction of gas in Pennsylvania of about 39 cents per MCF. The traditional small gas wells in the state that produce less than 60,000 MCF a day would be exempt. Would be exempt from the tax. That notwithstanding, the small guys are running radio ads here in western Pennsylvania saying they're against it, even though they're exempt from it. But you know, most of their drilling is exempt from the tax. So,
well, what that shows is it shows that the entire industry is united, no matter what their size. They're united against any tax.
Well, you know, Rick, that was an accurate statement up until, from my perspective, the last several weeks. What I've seen occur here in the last month or so has been a recognition by some of the major, the larger gas interest here in Pennsylvania. I think they recognize the inevitability of a severance tax. And I think they came to a position that they would rather deal with it now,
right,
rather than wait. And it's for two reasons, Rick. One is, right now the state only has about $200 million to fix the revenue shortfall that we have because we didn't get as much federal Medicaid reimbursements as we thought. So we need a couple hundred million dollars, and the governor needs about $75 million from a severance tax in order to handle that. So the state that does not have the dire revenue circumstances right now that we will be in next July. Because next July we lose the $2.7 billion in federal stimulus dollars that have been helping us balance our budget, and there are increased pension obligations for the state. So next July 1st, even if Houdini gets elected governor, he's not going to be able to get out of this problem simply by cutting. I mean, we have cut to the bone in the state budget over the last 2 years. You know, we've dealt with two significant budget deficits and a protracted budget without raising taxes. But when you lose another $3.5 billion after what we've been through, there's going to be a need for revenue come next July. Right. So the question will be where you get that revenue from. Okay?
Yep.
And I think members of the legislature are going to be more than, you know, they're going to be more inclined to look at a severance tax rather than raising the PIT or the sales tax to come up with revenue. They're not going to want to do that. And so I think the industry recognizes that next July the state's going to be in dire fiscal straits. We're going to need to raise revenue, and they know that they would be more likely to get a higher severance tax and a more onerous one on them next July than what they would get now. So they're willing to do that. So that's caused some in the industry, Rick, to change their position. Secondly, I got a call a couple of weeks, 3 weeks ago by somebody from the Dow Jones Industrials. And he was just asking me about, you know, the likelihood of passing this and what we're looking at and whatnot. At the end of the conversation, I asked him why he was interested in this. You know, why is he calling me? He says, well, you know, he happens to write a journal or something or a periodical for institutional investors. And they want to know. They want to know what's going on in Pennsylvania because they want to know whether or not to invest in these gas drillers. So, Greg, you know, one thing that businesses, including gas drilling interest, the thing that causes them the most difficulty in the market is uncertainty.
Absolutely.
It's uncertainty. If they knew what the tax is, they simply build it into their business model, which they already have because they pay it in every other state. So it's this uncertainty that's affecting their ability to raise capital on Wall Street. Okay. So the bigger companies, Rick, have split from the smaller ones, and they're more inclined and willing to negotiate a final compromise now than ever before.
Because that's an excellent point, because what we've been hearing from people is, well, you know, all the uncertainty, you know, we hear this in Washington. You know, businesses aren't expanding because they don't know what the groundwork's going to be. And I think it's an excellent point that you've made. By providing this now, by having the framework now, they're going to be able to move forward by knowing what the rules are.
Absolutely.
Excellent point. What else is in this bill right now? How's the money going to be divided? I've seen some interesting calculations here.
Yeah, on the I don't have my printout in front of me, but let me tell you this. It's here's what the distribution. And by the way, it'll generate if this takes effect on January 1st. Okay, it would go for 6 months to finish the second part of this fiscal year till June 20th. In that six-month period, it would generate approximately $130 million. From July 1st of 2011 until June 30th of 2012, it would generate approximately $300 million. And in fiscal year 12-13, it would generate approximately $350 million. The formula in the bill that we passed last night would distribute it as follows. 40% would go to the state general fund. 32% would go to the state's environmental stewardship fund, also known as Growing Greener. 16% would go to local governments. That's 88%. The remaining 12% would be distributed to county conservation districts, Pennsylvania Fish and Boat Commission, Pennsylvania Game Commission, Low-Income Energy Heating Assistance Program, Hazardous Sites Cleanup Fund, a little bit for a Disaster Emergency Contingency Fund, and a little bit of money to help fix up dams at lakes across the state. So each of them would get 1.5% or so of that remaining, for that remaining 12%. So that's pretty much the distribution.
Sounds reasonable.
It's weighted. Look, it is weighted much more heavily in favor of the environment and conservation than anything I thought we would be able to get out of the House. I mean, frankly, you know, I've been engaged in a tug of war, with the chairman of the Appropriations Committee on the Democratic side here, Dwight Evans from Philadelphia, who wanted you know, even more of it. You know, Dwight wants 70 or 80% of it to go to the state general fund. And I've been arguing that a majority of the money ought to go to conservation, environment, and local communities that are impacted. So I'm really happy. And when the bill started out on the floor in debate on Tuesday, it did have that 70% allocation to the general fund. But by the time the Harper Amendment was adopted, it basically flipped it so that the general fund would get 40 as opposed to 70% under the Evans plan, and the other 60% split between conservation, environment, and all those other environmental protection programs I mentioned.
That sounds reasonable to me. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Dave Levdansky, state representative from the 39th Legislative District. You know, one of the things that I've been harping on about this is there's got to be a way to make sure that Pennsylvania workers are the workers who are doing the drilling, who are the ones doing the feeder industries. We've got to benefit from this somehow. It's our natural gas. It's our resource. We should be benefiting from it. Is there any language in there to promote companies to hire Pennsylvania workers?
You know, that's a good point. Yes, there is. I too have shared that concern. I wanted to make sure. I think when you look at the whole Marcellus development, Rick, I think the first thing you got to make sure is that the environment is protected, especially the water. You know, and then secondly, we need to make sure we get the best economic development bang for the buck, so to speak. And then thirdly, you know, you need to make sure that you have an appropriate severance tax in place that enables you to make those investments in the conservation environment and local government stuff. Relative to the jobs development, I have been frustrated because I've had meetings with with, you know, the building trades out here in western Pennsylvania that are saying, you know, they've got 30-35% unemployment levels, and they see, you know, you go to these drill sites, I just see too many license plates on pickup trucks from Texas and Wyoming and Colorado and Louisiana and Oklahoma, and not enough from Pennsylvania. So there's two things we've done in a bill. One is we set aside $5 million a year for the next 3 years to help to be allocated to job training programs, to help the different VOTEC programs and community colleges and whatnot that are out there, vocational technical schools, to help train Pennsylvanians and give them the skills so that they can work in this industry. Second thing that we put in the bill is a tax credit to companies that they can apply to their corporate net income tax obligation. Okay. Not to the severance tax obligation, but they could use a tax credit as an offset to their corporate net income tax, and they can get up to a $1,000 tax credit per worker. Okay, with an overall cap at $10 million. Okay, I had language in the bill to make it even higher, make it a $2,500 tax credit, because that would then, because you got to recognize that these guys that are working from out of state, they'll come up here and work for like $15 an hour.
Yep.
Whereas our, you know, our prevailing rates tend to be more like $20-$25 an hour. So in order to make up for that differential, I wanted a higher tax credit. But again, that was watered down by the chairman of the Appropriations Committee when he introduced the amendment to Senate Bill 1155. So that's the two things that we did.
So this $5 million for job training. The money's going to people who are state certified. We're not going to just start seeing these fly-by-night places popping up saying, hey, come, you know, like an infomercial at midnight, come learn to drill on a rig, you know, and we'll give a whole bunch of money to that.
Well, I am concerned about that, okay? I mean, the language in the bill, I think we need to flesh that out even further because, yeah, I don't think that the job training money should be a handout to the companies who may want to start their own training programs. I think we can have maybe better language in the bill to make sure it gets directed to existing,
there you go,
you know, technical schools and training centers.
Last question I've got. Where does this go from here? Now that the House has passed it, it'll go to the Senate. What are the chances of it getting through there by Friday?
Look, the bill is in the Senate. Now, we took a Senate bill that had some language in it relative to counties, and we amended it to include the severance tax. Now, the Senate can do a couple of things. One, the first one, which I hope they would do, is they could consider the bill as it is, and if they disagree with it, they could vote to non-concur with the House amendments. That then would send the bill into a conference committee setting where you would essentially be able to have three members from the House and three from the Senate, but equal number from each parties that would negotiate a final compromise. So that's one option. The other option is the Senate could table that bill and maybe move their own severance tax bill and send it to the House. Okay?
Okay.
And I guess the third option would be to do nothing. But I think doing nothing is the worst option for both the citizens of Pennsylvania.
I agree.
And for our communities and for our environment as well.
Because what worries me is if it doesn't get passed now, I don't think it gets passed next year. Just my personal opinion.
Okay.
Dave, I appreciate your time.
Yeah.
Always great talking to you. Look forward to having you back real soon.
Okay, Rick. Thank you much.
Thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Some politicians say the unemployed won't look for work until their benefits run out.
Ed has been laid off from his pipe fitting job for over 18 months.
I'm here to tell you, being out of work is no fun. It sets you back in life. Benefits provide for less than half your wages. There's no health care, and your family suffers. To those politicians who think anybody would rather be collecting unemployment than working, I say come join us. We won't forget on Election Day.
This Labor Day message brought to you by the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, Richard Bloomingdale President, Frank Snyder, Secretary Treasurer.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Oh, we get our little fancy doilies. We get to put our little finger up in the air. Hootie hoo! I would love to go to one of those tea parties. Yes! And hopefully at the new tea party, where we can eat the fancy cookies on the little fancy dishes with the little cute little doily things, so we can hold our little pinkies high up in the air, like the aristocratic people do. Like the good people do. Maybe they'll hand out coloring books. Yes, maybe they'll hand out tea party coloring books just for kids. Calling it a wonderful book of the Tea Party for Kids, a St. Louis-based publisher has sold thousands of its Tea Party coloring book for kids. The book, complete with puzzles, mazes, connect the dots, promises to teach kids about liberty, faith, freedom, and so much more. We're not really making a political statement, publisher Wayne Bell told CBS News, though the book contains a good deal of far-right rhetoric. For example, it warns that government-run health care cannot be only by choice, can't be the only choice, and that when taxes are too high, the high taxes take away jobs and freedom. And it also says, in 1773, we had a tea party, and this led to the freedom from high taxes. The book explains to kids that simple-minded logic. This is the kind of history I want my children learning anyway. It goes on to say, today, we have having another tea party, and this will lead to freedom from higher taxes again. Never mind that 2009, tax rates were actually lower than they were in 1950. Never mind that. But you can get your Tea Party coloring book. While Bell said he is not a member of the Tea Party movement, activists seem to love the book, forcing Bell to print new copies every day to keep up with demand. The coloring book seems to be the latest, the latest profit scheme of people trying to profit off the Tea Twizzler movement. From for-profit Tea Party web forums to Fox News Glenn Beck holding in his Gold Line scam to the convention that cost almost $600 for people to get in. You know, just another exploitation, another way to make money off the simple-minded. Bell was asked, if he had any affiliation with the movement. He said, hey, I'm a salesman, okay? First and foremost, I'm a salesman, dude. I sell colored books for crying out loud. And really, that's what catches my opinion. Look, it's all about business. This guy could probably care less which side of the political spectrum you're looking at as long as you buy the stupid coloring book. And I've thought maybe we should come up with our own coloring book, the real Tea Party. We could have the cover say T-E-E-P-A-R-D-Y, Tea Party. We can have a whole bunch of illogical slogans, a whole bunch of typos and misspelled, like no pubic option. Or better yet, have a picture of George Bush standing at a podium saying, I know that human beings and fish can coexist peacefully. And then have
The human being and fish can coexist peacefully.
Yes, yes you do. And then there's Dick Cheney standing next to him shooting fish in a barrel. See, I think that would be good stuff. This is what the Tea Party needs to see. This rewritten history with a coloring book. We're going to teach kids history by coloring in between lines. See, that's how we learned it in the good old days, back on the reservation down in Texas. Oh, wait a minute. I was born in Connecticut. Never mind. And Margarita sent me this, which I thought is funny, talking about Tea Party history. It's the Tea Party Guide to American History by Phil Mole. He writes, tired of textbooks written by liberals who wipe their muddy feet on the American flag and won't be happy until our children are vegetarian, atheist, and gay? Then order the new Tea Party Guide to American History and save your child from the siren call of socialist homosexuality.
Socialist homosexual, that's a new one.
This book will teach your children no more or less than they need to know to be able to be defiant, admirable, unreflective perspective on the country's history. Things like American prehistory. This is what you'll learn. In 6,000 B.C., the land contained the present-day United States, created by God. Large masses of land surrounded the current United States. Those were also created for purposes only known in the heavens. The land containing the United States was designated for a special purpose by God, a future safe haven for the teachings of Jesus, and a place where women shouldn't be able to get abortions and a man should never use a condom. However, God's plan is marred when pockets of original sin develop in parts of the Northeast and Midwest, and in present-day California. These would become blue states. That's the kind of history you get in the new book on T. Twizzler history.
I don't know how to react to that.
No, the sad reality, and wow. this is what kind of frightening, is you've got people who listen to Glenn Beck and think he's Professor Beck. Yes, you know, the guy who's got more experience blowing, you know, white powder up his nose and, you know, whatever than he's got in a classroom, and somehow he's the most. He's the most respected guy on TV, huh? I like what he says.
He does have a chalkboard and chalk.
He's got a chalkboard. Maybe here's my theory on the chalkboard. You know, he gave up the white powder fetish a couple years ago, found Jesus. Now it's kind of reminded him of the old days. The white powder off the chalkboard kind of giving him, you know, maybe he's going to fall off the wagon soon.
Well, you made the analysis many times that you go from one obsession to another.
Yep.
And he's found it.
You want T-Twizzler history? The Reagan years. For 8 years, all poverty and violence in the United States came to an end. And Reagan says, tear down this wall, and Berlin Wall came down. Millions of sick children are also healed by touching the hem of Reagan's slacks. And the crumbs from Reagan's table miraculously fed millions more. And there was this time that a little boy was cornered by a bear. And the bear was really big and mean and was totally going to eat the boy. But then Reagan swooped down out of nowhere and simply smiled. And the bear stopped being mean. And he licked the little boy's face and gave him honey instead. Good American history. You got to love that. Now, the Clinton years were a little different. George W. Bush was president before this. But nothing really happened. Clinton got a, you know, little thing job there in the that office that was supposed to be white, was supposed to be round. But those liberals, you know, they screwed up the circle. And this shows the public that there's something wrong with liberalism. It always gets inherently, well, you know, leads to extramarital things and taxpayer subsidized, you know. I got to get this book. This is good, clean American history. Just like the Star Report, if you remember. Hundreds of pages of pornographic nonsense. If I remember the original reason for the Star investigation, it was a land deal. How a land deal turned into a, well, I can't really say what it was because I think I would be fined by the FCC. But you kind of know what happened in the Oval Office there with Clinton and the blue dress. How did it go from a failed land deal to a failed internship? I don't know. But, yeah, this is a great book, so I think we should all pick this up. And when we get our coloring book out, everybody will have – we should get that out by Christmas so that the teabaggers can have something to you know, put on their mantle. Because I don't really think that they would notice the misspellings. You know, I love some of them. You know, no amen, Steve. Or the my favorite one is Get a Brian's, you morains. They spell brains B-R-I-A-N and moron, M-O-R-A-I-N-S. But, okay, how about get a second grade education? Anyway, enough beating up on the tea parties right now. I just can't get over that. I really can't. This is a coloring book. I mean, stop and think about how immature that is. We're going to teach our children about real history. We're going to put a whole bunch of flowery pictures in there.
So I guess they're intimating by that comment about homosexuality that there are no capitalist homosexuals.
I don't know. You know, I don't know.
Wow.
I don't know. But, you know, and you want to learn about history? The good Revolutionary Wars in the early days of the Republic. In the new T. Twizzler history book, series of illustrations, there's George Washington and the cherry tree, George Washington in battle, the American flag flying high against blue back sky, beautiful pictures. Take a moment to reflect on these images and feel warm and good inside. This concludes the lesson on the Revolutionary War. Because that's basically all we know. Very nice. We're going to take a break. Right back with something a little more serious. 1-888-520-RICK. We're right back after this.
Not right wing, just race. The Rick Smith Show.
Some members of Congress complain that they have a really tough job. Also, they say their hard work is not appreciated by the public and that they're really not paid enough. Well, not to worry, Congress peoples, for I have the perfect cure for your job grievances. Become coal miners for a while. Talk about hard work, bad conditions, poor pay, and unappreciative bosses. Then there's that irritating thing about being killed on the job. You might remember that 29 miners were killed in April in a horrific explosion inside West Virginia's Upper Big Branch mine, owned by Massey Energy. Massey, a $2 billion a year giant, is notorious for putting its workers down in inexcusably unsafe coal mines. Last year, it was cited for more than 500 safety violations, and it had just received two more citations at Upper Big Branch on the very day of the murderous explosion. Such killings happen because coal corporations have used their campaign cash and lobbyists to make mine safety rules a cruel joke. After Massey's April explosion, however, public outrage prodded Congress to write tougher rules and put some teeth in safety enforcement. Great. But wait. Senate Republicans are now sitting down on the job, refusing to move this life and death legislation to passage. Their shameful work stoppage is meant to stall any action until after the November elections. Wealthy mine owners, you see, are pouring money into this year's Republican efforts to win control of the Senate in exchange for assurances that a GOP Senate would water down or kill these vitally needed safety reforms. This is Jim Hightower saying, what a disgrace. And they wonder why the public has no respect for them. I say that every soft-handed, pampered Congress critter who opposes these safety reforms should be sent to work in the mines for at least 2 years.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
Hello, I'm David Filman, executive director of AFSCME, Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. A union of over 1.4 million strong and growing, AFSCME is gaining improvements in the workplace all across America. And right here in the Commonwealth, more than 95,000 AFSCME members make Pennsylvania happen. Highways, libraries, hospitals, parks, offices, prisons, classrooms, museums, courtrooms. You'll find AFSCME members at work in all these places and many more.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
Today's AFSCME members take on public service jobs as diverse as they are, not for the recognition, but for a better Pennsylvania. For more information, please visit our website at AFSCME13.org. Labor is changing, so is your labor union. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happen!
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me we're gonna make it somehow. I heard a wise man say revolution starts now.
And now the second reading of the Tea Party history book. Turn to page 47 in your Tea Party history book. That's right, children. Open up the book. Read along with me about the Civil War. Yes, the war of Yankee aggression waged by the helpless Southerners who only wanted limited government, states' rights, and a nice sip of sweet tea. It wasn't about slavery, no, no. In fact, so-called slaves were better treated than most white males are, even to this day. Slavery was maybe possibly just maybe a little racist in retrospect. But slavery ended during the Civil War, and so did racism. None of that exists today. In fact, racism is just the opposite. Those black people hate us, and look all we've done for them. Okay, close your books. End of the Tea Party lesson for today. Boy, I sure hope my kids get to go to a school like that. I want my kids to learn ignorance and stupidity. I mean, to pollute a young mind with that kind of ridiculous nonsense just kind of scares the hell out of me. Because, you know, here's the thing. These are the future suitors for my two daughters. I mean, I've told you what my greatest fear in the world is. Tucker Carlson and Larry the Cable Guy coming to my house wanting to date my daughters. That's my greatest fear.
Tucker Carlson.
I mean, or like George Will or Tucker Carlson, either one.
With the bow tie.
With the bow ties. The bow ties would just, that would, then they would have to send the guys with the white coats to take me to that little padded room with the jacket with no sleeves. I would definitely, that would be the end of me. That would just be the
well,
end.
Well, I mean, we're making fun of this, but, you know, young minds can be molded. I mean, one of the most frightening things that I think I've ever seen as far as the future of this country is to see these young children at the KKK rallies wearing a hood and watching them burn the cross and repeat their racist hatred nonsense. Pseudo-Christianity. And then you wonder why when they become teenagers and they become young men, they speak the way they speak because they've heard it. It was their culture. It was drilled into their minds. And no matter how ignorant we think it is, no matter how wrong we think it is, if you're brought up in that culture and you think that's the way it is, that's the way you're going to live. And
You're just one of those hippie liberals.
To teach these things to impressionable minds.
You're just one of those long-haired hippie liberals.
Is a crime.
You're just one of those long-haired hippie liberals. I think you're right. And the sad thing is what's going on is we're teaching the young kids that it's okay to hate the Mexicans. I'll send them back. I forget what I was hearing. I turned on one of the talk shows, and I forget who it was on the way home, and I rarely, rarely ever do that. And there was a guy just railing about the fact that, well, what we need to do is get a big bus and ship them all back. And, you know, if they won't go back, we'll shoot them. I'm going, really? Is that what we're going to do? Is that what we're teaching? And then what I'm afraid of is that's what we're teaching the kids of the next generation, that it's okay to be that kind of hateful. Anyway, today, billionaire Rupert Murdoch, the Fox News guy, him and his media empire, he made a case to Congress that a broad immigration overhaul with a pass to citizenship for millions of illegal immigrants is critical to strengthening America's economy. His testimony before a House Judiciary Committee, the immigration panel, came as Democrats, senators Robert Menendez of New Jersey and Patrick Leahy of Vermont introduced a comprehensive immigration reform bill that includes a path to legalization, a temporary worker program, workplace and border enforcement measures, and the DREAM Act, which failed, as you remember, in the Senate last week. Now, remember, Murdoch is an immigrant. Came here from Australia. But he's not your typical immigrant. He came here with a lot of money, so we welcome him in the front door. The people who clean the toilets and cut the grass, they have to sneak across the border because our immigration laws are so screwed up. But as Murdoch points out, and we've talked about this before, it's complete nonsense, he says. It's nonsense to talk about expelling 12 million people. Not only is it impractical, it's cost prohibitive. And when you hear people say, well, we just get a big bus, we round them up, ship them right back. Good luck on that. Let me know how it works. You got a bus big enough to pull 12 million people around? And the answer is no. So we've got to figure out, again, adults in the room, you know, grown-ups, people who actually care about the country, have to figure out how we get out of this problem. And for me, it all starts in Mexico. We got to figure out how to get that. You want to prop up a government? You want a government that's going to be able to be functional? The heck with Afghanistan. You're never going to fix Afghanistan. Take your behind down to Mexico. Get those people functional. At least a little bit. Anyway, there was a study that Murdoch cited that shows a path to legalization would contribute about $1.5 trillion to the gross domestic product over the next decade. And now remember, look, I don't know what Murdoch's personal views politically are. I know his media empire is very conservative because that sells. Hate and anger and you know, that stuff sells. People like to get all ticked off. I know I like, you know, it catches my ire when something stupid happens. It's harder to be for something. And that's what I say about this program. We try to advocate for things. Like, I'd like to have an economy that the working people actually, can afford to make a living. That would be nice, wouldn't it?
Absolutely.
You wouldn't see 25% foreclosure rates? Anyway, Murdoch was joined at the hearing by New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Again, you know, this whole immigration thing. I don't know if the Republicans are honestly opposed to it or if they see it as purely a political issue that is divisive. I don't know if it's one of these things where we go, okay, the Democrats are on one side, we're going to take the other side. Or if the Republicans are on one side, the Democrats are automatic. I don't know.
I think a lot of it's driven by short-term political gain. I think it's at least for the moment, the spokesperson, what appears to be the official Republican line, I think they are appealing to the right wing. But I also have heard some Republicans that were moderates and they were reasonable. There is a solution there if they want to work to it. Again, we don't, you want to look at the big picture? How about addressing the issues of NAFTA, which is, again, we don't like to talk about it, but it's one of the major reasons, regardless of what the right wingers say. A lot of them are coming across that border because of the effects of NAFTA that have devastated large parts of the economy in Mexico. We don't even talk about that. If you're really serious, we have to approach immigration in a multifaceted way. Address the issues of poverty in Mexico, and then what do we do in a rational way with the immigrants that are in the United States? I mean, you can't build a wall high enough and strong enough to keep them out.
Sure we can.
And here's the irony. I mean, you talk about lads. It's laughable in a way. The same people that are advocating this huge wall, keep them all out. Keep them down Mexico. We don't, now I'm sounding like you. Keep them down Mexico because we don't want them, you know. Are you willing to spend the billions of dollars? No, we're not. We don't have it. So we have to approach this in a rational way. And then you do get to the issue, let's be honest. Although the undocumented are taking away some good jobs, they're also doing some of the jobs Americans don't want to.
Where you've got to start.
Right.
And as I said right from the beginning when this issue popped up, I say you go after the employers and you impose such draconian rules, such stiff penalties, that even if they were to think about it, it would be too expensive. It's the analogy I always use is prostitution. I don't think a prostitute should ever be arrested. That's too easy. You go after the John. You go after the demand. You know, if some guy, some married guy with five kids, if you really want to do away with prostitution, which I don't care, but if you really wanted to, you'd leave the prostitutes alone. You'd go after John because John's got everything to lose. Desperate people have nothing left to lose. So if you were going to walk across the border and risk dying in the desert, what makes you think you're going to give a rat's behind about if feeding your family is illegal in this country? No, you go after the people who have something to lose, the business owners. And you know what? If they want corporate personhood, we lock their behinds up. Make them guests of the state.
No.
You'll see things change in an awful hurry.
Some of these conservatives that shoot their mouth off about how tough the problem is when you come right down to it. We don't want to penalize the business people too much. They want to smack their fingers. Oh, they want to address it.
They want their campaign.
They want to address it. They want to smack their fingers a little bit, give them a little fine. You know what? If that business person knows they're going to jail, no ifs and buts or ands about it, they're going to stop it.
Oh, you'll have the Whitman thing. Well, I didn't know. I went through a temp agency. Well, you know, hey, ignorance is no excuse, remember? Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back after this.
It is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
Washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Workers in the late 1930s began exerting their recently guaranteed right to organize and join unions. Millions of workers flocked to join the labor organization of their choosing to collectively bargain for better wages, hours, and working conditions. Factory, mill, and mine owners, not eager to embrace the changes, fought vehemently to deny workers their rights. As company tactics grew more heavy-handed and brutal, the workers' organizing methods changed. Sit-down strikes became a way for workers to demand their rights and to force management to listen. With a wave of a handkerchief, the tip of a hat, workers would shut down their machines, lay down their hammer, and sit down. Workers at the Hershey Chocolate Factory in Hershey, Pennsylvania, seeking to reduce the 60-hour-long work week, decided to form a union. Initially, an agreement was reached, but as the economy took a downturn, the company willfully violated the agreement by laying off the most senior workers, those who just happened to be the most ardent union supporters. The workers voted to strike the very next day. At 11 a.m. on April 2nd, 1937, a red handkerchief was waved and the workers began the first sit-down strike in Pennsylvania's history. The company reacted by forming the Loyal Workers Club. These strikebreakers consisted of hired thugs from New York City and local farmers, dairy producers, and shopkeepers who were dependent on the factory. On April 6, Hershey organized a loyalty parade. After hours of rallying speeches, the lathered-up Loyal Workers Club mob found pipes and clubs that had been manufactured at the Hershey planing mill. The angry mob headed to the Hershey factory to throw their strikers out. Songs of solidarity sung by the striking workers could be heard from inside the factory as the angry mob burst into the plant. Blocking the only exit, the Loyal Workers Club, loyal only to management and greed, began pummeling the workers as they tried to escape. The assault left numerous workers bloody and beaten, many unconscious. Within days, Hershey reopened and recognized the renamed version of the Loyal Workers Club. In May of 1938, the National Labor Relations Board ruled Hershey had violated the law and the company union was dissolved. Soon the workers joined the Bakery and Confectionery Workers Local 464, who have faithfully represented the workers ever since. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
spot back to America. Rick Smith.
Our friends over at Think Progress write, earlier this week, NBC News and the Wall Street Journal released a new poll surveying Americans' views on trade. The poll found that 69% of Americans thought that free trade agreements in the U.S. has taken a part in the cost of jobs, and 53% of Americans think these agreements hurt the country as a whole. Increasingly, the poll also found that opposition to free trade agreements is particularly strong amongst Americans who define themselves as Tea Party supporters. 61% of self-described Tea Party supporters said they thought free trade has harmed the United States, just 4% less than union members. Let me say that again. 61% of people who call themselves Tea Party supporters thought free trade was harming this country, just 4% less than union members. Now, you know, you got to wake up and realize that trade is the way we get out of this mess. Changing our trade policies is what's going to help this country. And I don't know that the Tea Party people really understand what these candidates that they've supported, what their position on free trade is. Rand Paul, the Tea Party darling. Paul's campaign website boasts that the candidate wants to, quote, engage the world in free trade. He's also bragged that he would stand up to unions to get free trade agreements with Peru, Panama, and South Korea passed through Congress. This guy's actually got a shot of winning in Kentucky. Guy who wants to pass those free trade agreements. Joe Miller, the guy from Alaska, another Tea Party favorite. Responding to a candidate survey earlier this month, said that he was in favor of the United States involvement in free trade agreements. Jim DeMint, who, quote, has embraced the Tea Party movement more enthusiastically than most of his GOP colleagues, is a strong backer of free trade. He has voted to support every new free trade agreement that has come before the Senate over the past 5 years, and writes on his website that he sees backing a new free trade agreement as the key to a strong economy. You look at Marco Rubio, another Tea Party guy. They allowed him to coast to the Republican nomination in the Senate. Writes on his campaign website that, quote, we should adopt the free trade agreement that we have already been negotiating with Colombia, Panama, South Korea, and all around the nation. You go to Mike Lee in Utah, another Tea Twizzler, quote, that one of the best ways we can improve our economy is more free trade. Pat Toomey, another guy, another free trade guy, supported free trade agreements with Australia, Chile, and Singapore while he was a congressman. He's also slammed the Democratic presidential primary candidates Hillary Clinton, Obama, and Edwards as collectivists for skepticism over free trade deals with South Korea and a willingness to alter NAFTA. Look, I'm telling you folks, at some point we got to look at these trade agreements and say, you know what? We've given too many jobs away. We've given our economy away. And if you remember Paul Craig Roberts, and I'm saddened to say that this guy, who I think is a moderate Republican, he was the former Assistant Treasury Secretary under Reagan, but a guy who, honestly, you can have a discussion with in a sane and rational fashion. The quote that I love from him is, we're the only nation in the world who gives our prosperity away for nebulous foreign policy gains. So, you know, we say, well, you know, here, take a little industry and let us open your country up. Or who knows what some of the bizarre reasons are or the rationales. But what we do is we've given our prosperity away. For what? I would say we've given it away so that the very wealthy can get even wealthier. And to put us union members, to put us working people back in our place.
Well, you just quoted one of the Tea Twizzlers, I think it was Toomey, criticizing criticizing Obama and criticizing Mrs. Clinton for coming out against some of the things that are happening with free trade. Truth is, Bill Clinton himself, if I know I'm accurate, during the 2004 presidential campaign, he came out and said, look, I was the president and I pushed it. But he said, you know, it's not working the way it should. We need to step back. He didn't say we should eliminate them. What he said was we need to step back and look at what's happening and adjust it and make it fair for everyone, including the American worker. That's the difference between Bill Clinton, who, again, was the president when we voted it in. He was out in front leading the parade. And Bill Clinton is saying, look, we gotta step back. Some of these Republicans, their answer is no. No, the answer is we don't have enough. Well, that's obscene. I mean, you talk about the classic definition of insanity is to do the same thing and expect a different result.
I look at the fact, and you look at cell phones. There were 1.2 billion cell phones sold in 2008. 1.2 billion of them. Not one of them were made here in this country. Yet I would say probably you probably sold at least 50 million of them here in the U.S., a really conservative number. We used to produce things. We used to produce the things that we purchase. You know, I remember as a kid, all my toys were made in either Chicago or Massachusetts. None of those are made there anymore. In fact, everything seems to be made in China. Why'd we do that? Well, we did that so that the profiteers, the people who own the country, the stockholders, the big, not people who own a little 401k or have a little investment in a couple of shares. You're nothing compared to the institutional investors, the people who really own the stocks, the people who really control the boards of directors. They've just given you a couple of shares to make you think that you have a say. You don't. Like George Carlin said, it's a big club and you ain't in it. You and I are not in the big club. And what I say, what has to happen, we have to stop this partisan, ridiculous nonsense, because here is an issue that even the most headstrong Tea Party supporter and I can agree on. I really believe this, that we can agree that in order for this country to be successful, in order for us to be the prominent, dominant, superpower country that we all want or think we are, we have to be able to produce things. We have to be able to build the things that we consume, or at least build the stuff we need to blow other people up with. It's really concerning to me that we don't make the little chips that make the smart bombs smart. Experts are saying now we may not have enough bullets to shoot enough people. There's a problem here. And this is, to me, very common sense. And this is why I think we have to get the money out of politics, why the Supreme Court decision that gave the Citizens United, that gave people, corporations, unlimited spending capabilities, why this was so devastating. And you watch in the coming days, the Supreme Court is going to rule that they have privacy rights. And that you and I will never know what these corporations do because they're people. And they have the right to privacy. The right to the Fifth Amendment. I'm sorry, I don't think a corporation should have that right. Sorry, I just don't. But we seem to be moving down that path. You look at the fact that we've lost millions of jobs. Since 2001, one of the stories I read, over 42,000 factories have closed. 75% of those employed people, more than 500 people out of place. I mean, that is just an alarming statistic. And the fact that our auto industry has been so badly decimated, and the capability to produce has shrunk so badly. If you remember World War II, you're reading your books, reading history books, if the T-Twizzlers haven't destroyed them all and replaced them with cartoons. We won World War II because we could produce in amazing amounts. We turned car plants into tank plants. We don't have that capability anymore, folks. We're losing it. We're losing it every day. And who's taking it over? Nobody's taking it. We're giving it. Willingly, we seem to be doing. Right now, the Democrats have finally come up and figured out, well, we better do something. And where are the Republicans? Steadfast in opposition. We're going to take a quick break. I'm telling you, Saturday, we got to get to Washington. We got to make our voices heard. The jobs, the economy, that's what we need to be talking about. We're going to take a quick break. We're back with Liz Schuler from the AFL-CIO.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. President Obama is urging working people nationwide to vote November 2nd to prevent a return to Republican economics that have devastated working families.
In the period when they were in power, from 2001 to 2009, job growth was slower than it had been in any decade since World War II. Between 2001 and 2009, middle class incomes fell by 5%.
Union workers and their supporters across Europe protested economic austerity measures by European governments on Wednesday. The 60 million member European Trade Union Confederation called the protests. AFL-CIO International Representative Penny Schantz participated in the Brussels protest along with some 100,000 workers.
There's 23 million unemployed in Europe. There are millions of European citizens who've been made vulnerable and insecure, and there's a growing massive social tension across Europe. So to cope with the situation, the only response Europe's governments have been able to come up with is basically to adopt these austerity measures. This could lead Europe into a recession and result in even more unemployment. I think workers would agree in Europe and in America that we didn't cause the crisis. And the bill has to be paid by banks and not by workers. We reject the austerity plans in Europe and the cuts in wages and pensions, the insecurity and unemployment among young people, and deregulation of labor standards.
Seasonal retail hiring is expected to be up this year, Jesse Russell reports.
It isn't steady work, but it could give some of the chronic unemployed in the country brief relief. Human resources consulting firm Challenger Gray & Christmas released a report this week that suggests 2 months of consecutive retail sales gains could signal to retailers they may need to increase their seasonal hiring. 2008 saw a 22-year low in hiring, with employers only adding 384,000 seasonal jobs. 2009 was slightly better, with more than 500,000 jobs. The firm also said retail layoff announcements have plummeted by 65% in comparison to the same time last year. Some announcements by retailers this week seem to verify the firm's predictions. Toys R Us, JCPenney, Best Buy, and Macy's have all said they will hire a combined 169,000 seasonal workers.
One of the largest employers in Wisconsin could be headed for a strike. Workers at Kohler Company in Kohler, Wisconsin, have authorized the negotiating committee to call for a strike if a contract agreement can't be reached before the current contract expires on Friday. Nearly 2,300 of the company's employees are represented by the UAW. This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit Labor Radio.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You know, on Saturday, we're going to the One Nation Working Together rally. I don't know if it's a march, but we're going to the rally. We're taking the whole clan down, jumping on a bus, and going to go down and participate and see firsthand. I mean, we're going to I'm sure the right is going to spin it that nobody showed up, and maybe Fox will show some pictures that they've dug up from their archives and try and pass that off as actual news again. But we're going to go down and take a look at it. And I suggest that everybody who has the opportunity get out and show your support and just have a great day. I've got Liz Schuler on the line. She's Secretary Treasurer of the AFL-CIO. AFL-CIO.org is the website. Going to talk a little bit about why we should be there. Liz, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for having me on the show, Rick.
You know, I'm looking at this, and what's the point?
Well, the point is that I think Americans are desperate for jobs. They want to see this economy turn around. So we're bringing together tens of thousands of working people to gather at the mall and come together really for under the banner of jobs, justice, and education for all. And it's about a month out from this election that we're all watching, November 2nd. So we think that this will be a great rallying point to really get the attention of the public and folks that are running for re-election.
You know, as I've seen these kind of things happen on the right, the last one being Becca Palooza, it's always been about division. It's always been about, you know, it's only about us and, you know, the heck with everybody else. At least that's my take on it.
Right.
I'm hoping this will be something different where we're talking about how do we unify the country.
You're absolutely right, and that has been one of the messages we've been trying to get out is, you know, we want to rebuild this economy that so it'll benefit the middle class and the working people of America. And we're actually fueled by hope, not hate. And we don't want to see people using this kind of caustic language to divide working people. We need to unite people. So really, this rally, we think, is going to be an opportunity to bring together, you know, groups, human and civil rights organizations, young workers, students, the religious community, the peace and environmental groups, all under one umbrella to really send a message.
You know, I don't want to be overly I don't want to be divisive here, but, you know, in looking at some of the issues that we're talking about, unemployment, for instance, the people on the right, you know, what I'm hearing, especially from our gubernatorial candidate, Tom Corbett, right here, is not much love for people who are unemployed. In fact, our gubernatorial candidate said that the first thing he would do to help solve the problem would raise payroll taxes on workers and then maybe cut the checks of the people who are unemployed. So it's not a matter of being divisive. It's a matter of being honest, I think.
Right, and I think you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, we need to actually invest in job creation and not hurt the people who are the ones that are, you know, in need for jobs. So I'm actually going to be speaking to a rally that the machinists are holding prior to the One Nation March. They call it U-Cubed, and it's really a group that's advocating for the rights of unemployed workers. So we're going to have a pre-rally for unemployed workers and all kinds of folks coming together to support this notion of, you know, the government needs to start creating jobs and investing in things like infrastructure and the green economy and other opportunities to rebuild this middle class.
Well, I say the Republicans have created a couple of jobs here recently, to be honest. And they got somebody to print up that pledge thing that they had.
Oh, right.
And if you saw it, it was 27 pages of pictures of white people, about 10 pages of fluff, and the rest rehashed, proven, failed political rhetoric.
Right.
But the key being 27 pictures of white people. I'm hoping this rally on Saturday will look a lot more like the country as a whole than 27 pages full of white people.
No, you're absolutely right. We have been, as I said, working in coalition with groups from all across the spectrum, and it's really going to be, you know, the complete picture of what we want America to look like.
So let me ask you this. What are your plans after this rally? Because I'm hoping that we're going to have a mass influx of people converging on Washington, excited, activated. How do we then turn that into a movement beyond October 2nd? How do we bring those people into the fold and keep them energized?
Well, that is really going to be the challenge because, as you know, up to this point, a lot of voters have felt so little disaffected and a little perhaps down about how things have been looking in the economy. But the labor movement actually has been doing work, you know, for several months now in talking to our members and getting our members educated and mobilized and motivated, really, to come out to the polls. So we're taking this as a jumping-off point, really, to kick up the Labor 2010 mobilization into yet a higher gear. We're actually doing satellite events across the country because not everyone can get to Washington, D.C. So in cities all across the country, we're doing neighborhood walks, you know, getting union members out to talk on the doorstep to other union members, and really start educating folks on the issues that, that matter in this election. And I think it's very clear, and as you said, with this latest document the Republicans put out, that, you know, they simply want to go back to the failed policies of the past and the last 8 years with the Bush years. We want to keep this country moving forward. We think, you know, the president and the folks in Congress have been, you know, moving in the right direction, and we want to continue to see progress.
Yeah, I'm there with you. One of the things that I'm hoping comes of this, and the steel workers have been out in front, other unions have been working on a manufacturing policy, some sane trade policies. I don't know if you've seen some of the numbers, but we've lost more than 42,000 factories in 9 years in this country. Millions and millions of jobs. Our productive capacity is lower than it's been in 100 years.
Absolutely. No, I think manufacturing, revitalizing manufacturing is going to be the key to turning this economy around among, you know, other proposals. But really, we don't make anything in this country anymore. Very few things are still made in the USA. And I think people are finally waking up to, you know, this notion that it's all of this offshoring and all of the policies, trade policies and trade laws that haven't been enforced have been contributing to the demise and the decline of American manufacturing. And I'm happy to see that congressional Democrats have actually proposed part of their election strategy is make it in America. And so they're really pushing hard on the idea that we must revitalize manufacturing in our country.
You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Liz Schuler, Secretary Treasurer at the AFL-CIO, their website, AFLCIO.org. You know, I'm under the impression that your job is to reach out to the younger generation of workers, explain to them what it is that unionization is and how it's good, how it would be good for them. And I'm hoping that this march will help in that way. But I'm curious, you know, seeing some of the numbers coming out, the census data showing 44 million Americans living under the poverty line. I think that statistic alone is something to be a selling point to say, look, joining a union, collectively bargaining for better wages, hours, and condition is a way to raise all of us up.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. And you saw you mentioned the poverty numbers that just came out, and young people have been hit disproportionately. And are, you know, further behind than other young people in their generations previous. So once they start out behind, it makes it more and more difficult for them to actually catch up. And we're seeing, like you said, young people disenfranchised more than ever before. And so we've made it a priority in the labor movement to really start reaching out to young people, letting them know that there really is a place for them in the labor movement and that they too can access high-quality jobs with good training and benefits. As we know, in today's economy, certainly those good jobs are hard to come by. So we think the labor movement can be a leader in, you know, speaking on behalf of young people.
Outstanding. Now, on the other side of that spectrum, the elderly in the country have not done as poorly. And I think the message has to be, look, the elderly have not sunken into poverty because there is a social safety net under them. It's called Social Security.
Mm-hmm, right.
And we need to strengthen that.
Absolutely. And as you've seen, many candidates on the fringes are talking about privatizing Social Security. And so we have made it a point in the labor movement, especially when mobilizing and educating our members, to take a look at those candidates and where they stand on issues like Social Security. And really, once you start, you know, digging down and looking at the policy positions of these candidates, it becomes very clear who is on their side. And so we're, you know, doing phone banks and walks and worksite flyers to make sure that our members really realize the importance of this election.
And it is an important election. This October 2nd, this Saturday, One Nation Working Together, the website onenationworkingtogether.org. I want to pull back to this for a second. What kind of festivities, what kind of activities are going to be going on there for those people who want to attend?
Well, really, there are going to be a number of satellite events going on before the rally. The official rally gets started at 11 o'clock on the Mall. There'll be a huge stage, and we predict tens of thousands of working people coming together. I myself am going to be participating in, as I mentioned, a rally for the unemployed earlier in the morning, as well as a rally for young people, young workers, to come together at Freedom Plaza at 10:45 to march over to the One Nation Rally Together, you know, really to highlight the issues of young people. So we expect there are going to be all kinds of events going on leading up to this One Nation March. There'll be a stage with speakers and music, and I think just really seeing the solidarity on the Mall is going to be really a very motivating and inspirational type of event that will really, you know, kick things up into high gear for the coming election.
Yeah, I hope that to be, and I'm pretty sure this is going to be a great event, and I can guarantee that no matter what happens, Fox News will report that no one was there and nothing happened that day.
Yes, there's always a competition, right?
Absolutely. Liz Schuler, Secretary Treasurer of the AFL-CIO, AFL-CIO.org. I appreciate your time, and we will see you on Saturday.
Thanks, Rick.
All righty. Thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this.
Controversial, thought-provoking, opinionated. Rick Smith.
Some politicians say the unemployed won't look for work until their benefits run out.
Ed has been laid off from his pipe fitting job for over 18 months.
I'm here to tell you, being out of work is no fun. It sets you back in life. Benefits provide for less than half your wages. There's no health care, and your family suffers. To those politicians who think anybody would rather be collecting unemployment than working, I say come join us. We won't forget on Election Day.
This Labor Day message brought to you by the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, Richard Bloomingdale President, Frank Snyder, Secretary Treasurer.
Official supporter of Palin Santorum 2012, The Rick Smith Show.
Yes, she does. Yes, she does. Something kind of, you know, kind of interesting about Christine O'Donnell. It's a little something interesting, you know. I don't know that she's quite got that Michelle Bachmann crazy that I like, but you know, she kind of plays that. I'm trying to think of the right words to use, the little weird thing, little vibe she's got.
Peppy
going on.
Little flirt.
Yeah, kind of, you know, 16-ish. You know, she acts like a little teeny bopper.
Yeah,
that's the vibe I get from her. Again, gold digger, but, you know, trying to be 16
with,
gold digger.
With the Pepsi smile.
That's it. Anyway, in the O'Donnell news of the day, it seems like every day somebody else is looking into her background that they haven't been looking into for the last who knows how many years that she's been a perpetual candidate. And we're finding out that, look, you know, Gold Digger had some great ideas. That's what we're going to start calling her now. You know, like the movie Goldfinger?
Mm-hmm.
She's Gold Digger. So Gold Digger had a nice little scam going. Perpetual candidate, taking a bunch of money, pay your rent, pay your bills. Yeah, it works out. Now they're saying this nonprofit she was running, this nonprofit evangelical group, Savior's Alliance for Lifting the Truth, or SALT. Not quite sure about the whole SALT thing. But anyway, turns out she hasn't bothered to file any of her paperwork, with the IRS. So here's another reason for the Tea Party to be angry at the IRS. Cause she's dim-witted and couldn't find accounting services in the phone book. And again, you know, probably didn't learn. For as many colleges as she claimed she went to, you would think one of them would have taught her taught her her ABCs, because, you know, you go to the A section and then the C section. AC, okay, yeah, ACC, oh, sure. Accounting. you find yourself an accountant. That's what they do. But I guess that would cut into the profits. And I guess that would be bad if you're a gold digger. After a series of embarrassing interviews, O'Donnell imposed a national media blackout on her campaign. So the more questions they asked her about her campaign and the more she couldn't answer them and the deeper she got in the hole, she said, you know, I'm not doing this anymore. Good Republican stunt. But before she did this, she sat down with the Christian Broadcasting Network to talk about her, you know, her problems. Reflect a little bit. Talk about her primary campaign. She said that God continued to strengthen and empower us. When you know his strength is perfected in our weakness, that's exciting. So I'm sure that, you know, people, oh, I love that. I'm going to send some money to the gold digger. Here's your gold digger. Here's some money. Because you see that if it weren't for faith, when all logic said it's time to quit and we pursued and we marched on because we knew God was releasing us to quit. He was not. He just wasn't going to let us go. He had us right there by the short hairs. Have the checks come yet? I mean, come on. Why is it that when we see people on the, and I've said this before, why is it when we see people on the street corners who claim that God speaks to them, we look at them with a jaundiced eye and we say that we should put them away. But when some wackadoo like this, who's got a bunch of really questionable things in her past, we just, she's just a wonderful person. Now look, I'm not perfect. I've got a bunch of stuff. I got a bunch of skeletons in my closet.
That's hard to believe.
I got a bunch of things I don't want my kids to ever hear about, which is why you'll never see me run for Senate. But if you've put yourself in this position, look, they're going to come after you. They're going to dig and they're going to vet and they're going to make sure that you paid your taxes on time. Look what they did to Daschle and a lot of the Democrats. So don't say this, oh, it's a partisan thing. No, no. It's you're the flavor of the week, honey. And they're going to take a bite.
So we can officially cross you off the 2014 senatorial perspective candidate list, Rick?
My wife said she'd put a bullet in my head before she let me run for any political office. And, you know, maybe part of it is maybe how deep we get into people's background is a problem. Maybe we should be talking about the issues, but here's the thing. Here's somebody who, you know, goes policy after policy. She's an abstinence-only advocate. Yet during her years in college, she admitted she was basically a floozy. You know, she was the town doorknob. Everybody got a turn.
Oh.
Are you going to give me that O now? You know, she starts a nonprofit. She doesn't pay taxes. Yet somehow she's going to be able to be fiscally responsible with the purse of Congress. Somehow she made a living on $5,800, gave her campaign over $3,000. So she made $2,700 to feed herself and put a roof over her head. I don't know anybody who can do that. Maybe we should have her in the Senate because if she can figure out how to live for an entire year on $2,700 and dress the way she does and eat out in restaurants and live in a nice house, drive a decent car, maybe we should put her in the Senate because maybe she can figure out our budget woes. Maybe Gold Digger can figure out how to finagle the numbers and fudge the numbers.
Remember when Clinton was going through his problems in the White House with all this, he was accused of having all those affairs. And I had Republicans, again, who were fairly intelligent, sane, and they would tell me, well, I can't trust him. I can't trust him to be president. If he's going to lie about something like this, why I can't trust him. But yet here you have a candidate who has been caught repeatedly, lie after lie after lie, and in their eyes, she's still credible. It is absolutely amazing. And what sets this group apart, and if you think about it, it should be a little disconcerting, no matter what they've done in the past.
They're
no
forgiven.
Matter what their record.
They're forgiven.
They are accepted. They're one of they're one of them.
All you got to do is say, I found
Jesus. We're the Tea Party, and we're the revolution.
I found Jesus. He was in the back of the trunk. I opened the door, and there he was. And I said, thank you, Lord. Thank you, Jesus. I am forgiven, and all the people around me will forgive me and throw me money and shower me. But heaven forbid that you turn out to be like Pastor Ted or the good Bishop Long is being accused of being a homosexual. And then they turn their back on you because, of course, you know, Jesus would be anti-gay. Mm-hmm. And I got a bunch of friends who, you know, they were the Beck caricatures. They're the Beck types who they were alcoholics. They were drug addicts. They had a bunch of problems. And then they found Jesus and now they're preaching. Just crazy. Speaking of crazy, Michelle Bachmann. Remember her back in 2007 during the State of the Union address when she basically molested the president? When she just wouldn't let Bush go. You remember that?
I saw the clip tonight.
Yeah, she's over there holding on his shoulder.
She held on him like she had, you know, those gloves, yeah. the wide receivers.
The Vulcan
NFL.
The Vulcan death pinch. She's Spock. Well, it turns out she's decided that she's not a big fan of Bush. I mean, first she's trying to, you know, she's trying to take him down, and now not so happy. You got to listen to this ad.
Yeah. Government spending doesn't create good jobs. That's why I fought and voted against the Bush Wall Street bailout, the failed Pelosi $1 trillion stimulus, and Obama's government takeover of health care. It's small business owners who know we need to get government out of the way. Congress can help by cutting government spending, lowering taxes, and reducing unnecessary regulations. I'm Michelle Bachmann, and I approve this message. Together we can get our economy moving forward again.
Yeah, and as soon as I get my meds, I'll be happy again. Did you hear that though? I fought against the Bush Wall Street bailouts. You know, the guy she was trying to take down. So she's basically thrown George under the bus, as the whole conservative movement has done. Bush is like the redheaded stepchild of the GOP. They've facelift him right out of the party, which is kind of funny, and you knew they would. But they've pretty much. They fed him to the lions.
Although you can bet most.
To use a biblical term, they fed him to the lions.
Most of the Tea Party, I'm sure, not only voted for him once, they voted for him twice.
And they'd probably have voted for him a third time.
Probably would have.
But, you know, she basically pitched him right under the bus. And, you know, I was looking at the video of her. Wow, she's getting crazier looking. I mean, her eyes, you know, she had really nice eyes at one point. Now they're just like void of any life. And she's like, if you listen to the ad, there's no breath in between. It's kind of like, it's very robotic. I voted against the Bush Act, not ending the Pelosi takeover of health care. It was really, it was kind of creepy. I mean, some of these ads to me are just getting really out there. And speaking of George Bush, speaking of out there, yesterday the George W. Bush Institute. That's right, the George W. Bush Institute, based here at Southern Methodist University, the innovative arm of the George W. Bush Center. That's right next to the Tea Party coloring book room and the Very Hungry Caterpillar room, where they have lunch, of course. And that's basically the Bush Library. They've announced their first major initiative. That's right, folks, the Bush the George W. Bush Institute, its innovative arm, has come out with its first major initiative. They're going to train principals and prepare them for service in public schools across the country. Help me if I'm wrong here. Don't you already have to go through some type of training to become a principal? The Institute says its goal is to train half the nation's principals to be principals in the next decade, even though they are principals. It's kind of interesting. The Institute is aiming to certify 50,000 public school principals by 2020, which is kind of ironic that this is the first major initiative of the Bush Institute, because if you remember, the National Association of Secondary School Principals were adamantly opposed and criticized him roundly for a number of his policies. I mean, they were not his friend. The president of the National Association of Secondary School Principals criticized the president for deciding to shortchange public schools and undermine their ability to improve student achievement. So I find it odd, unless we're talking about instead of the word train, we are going to switch that with the word brainwash. Maybe that's it. Maybe we're going to make them little minions. I don't know. Kind of makes you wonder. But it makes me wonder why this would be his first initiative. You would think it would be something with Iraq or maybe that's what the dart hit on the dartboard when they were, let's see what topic. Get out the dartboards.
He's got to do something, Rick. I mean,
go back to the ranch with no animals and stay there. You and Bin Laden can sit and watch TV all day long on the ranch with no animals. You know, again, you know, stay out of public. You've done enough to destroy the country. Anyway, let's take a quick break. We're right back with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. We're right back.
You know I told you once tonight that you could always speak your mind. You worked so hard to say what's right. I watched you do it all the time.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Some members of Congress complain that they have a really tough job. Also, they say their hard work is not appreciated by the public and that they're really not paid enough. Well, not to worry, Congress peoples, for I have the perfect cure for your job grievances. Become coal miners for a while. Talk about hard work, bad conditions, poor pay, and unappreciative bosses. Then there's that irritating thing about being killed on the job. You might remember that 29 miners were killed in April in a horrific explosion inside West Virginia's Upper Big Branch mine, owned by Massey Energy. Massey, a $2 billion a year giant, is notorious for putting its workers down in inexcusably unsafe coal mines. Last year, it was cited for more than 500 safety violations, and it had just received two more citations at Upper Big Branch on the very day of the murderous explosion. Such killings happen because coal corporations have used their campaign cash and lobbyists to make mine safety rules a cruel joke. After Massey's April explosion, however, public outrage prodded Congress to write tougher rules and put some teeth in safety enforcement. Great! But wait. Senate Republicans are now sitting down on the job, refusing to move this life and death legislation to passage. Their shameful work stoppage is meant to stall any action until after the November elections. Wealthy mine owners, you see, are pouring money into this year's Republican efforts to win control of the Senate in exchange for assurances that a GOP Senate would water down or kill these vitally needed safety reforms. This is Jim Hightower saying, what a disgrace. And they wonder why the public has no respect for them. I say that every soft-handed, pampered Congress critter who opposes these safety reforms should be sent to work in the mines for at least 2 years.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
Hello, I'm David Filman, executive director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. A union of over 1.4 million strong and growing, AFSCME is gaining improvements in the workplace all across America. And right here in the Commonwealth, more than 95,000 AFSCME members make Pennsylvania happen. Highways, libraries, hospitals, parks, offices, prisons, classrooms, museums, courtrooms. You'll find AFSCME members at work in all these places and many more.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
Today's AFSCME members take on public service jobs as diverse as they are, not for the recognition, but for a better Pennsylvania. For more information, please visit our website at AFSCME13.org. Labor is changing, so is your labor union. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happen!
We'll be right back.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds. Don't you know?
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show. Progressive talk with a conscience.
While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for
our quote of the day. And I got to tell you, you know, we beat up on the Tea Party, and, you know, there's just so much. There really is. But our quote of the day comes from Representative Paul Brown, Republican from Georgia. He held an American Speaks Out town hall meeting earlier this month. And here's the quote. I'll tell you, we got some problems in Washington, got some big problems. Just today, the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta said people in America are not eating enough fruits and vegetables. They want to give all the power to the federal government to force you to eat more fruits and vegetables. This is what the federal CDC, they're going to make it. They're going to be calling you, make sure you're eating your fruits and vegetables. Every day, this is socialism in the highest order.
Is he talking to food police here, Rick?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the conspiracy theories in these people's minds, where do they think we're going to... We can't get pool inspectors. We can't get people. We fired those people. We're going to start hiring food people to come to your house. Have your vegetables today, young man. Really? Really? We're going to do that?
Your government wants you healthy.
How dare they? How dare they want me to live? Those farting bastages.
It's probably correct. A lot of people don't eat enough fruits and vegetables.
Yeah, but come on. Are we... work with me here. We're not going to be hiring people to knock on your...
I understand that.
Open up! Food police! Put down the Twinkie! Better be a celery stick.
Just like the book 1984, huh?
Well, I mean, they've already got that technology. They can, right through your TV set, you can have a meeting through your TV. Look at Skype.
Skype, yes.
I got to tell you,
I've been to meetings with the use Skype, yeah.
Orwell must have really been doing some great LSD or something to have that kind of vision. Kind of amazing stuff. Healthcare. The big story here, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has signed two key healthcare bills that make California the first in the nation to begin establishing its own health insurance exchange. This is a key component of the federal healthcare overall. This gives access to coverage to millions of people across the country, and I think it's great that California, especially Schwarzenegger, while he has no worries about re-election, I'm sure he can't wait to get out of Dodge. But I'm glad to see that he did this. And he said in the statement, for the reform to succeed, it will have to be up to the states to make it work. And California is moving forward on reforms that will provide affordable and quality health care for everyone. The bill, Senate Bill 900 and Assembly Bill 1602, would establish the California Health Benefit Exchange and an independent 5-member oversight board that will be tasked with defining how the exchange would operate. They've got to do it by January of 2014, and we've got to talk about how to do it here. It goes on to say at least 2 million Californians could be eligible to immediately buy insurance from the exchange once it's open for business. The exchange would help funnel billions of dollars in subsidies to help Californians and small businesses obtain health care coverage. You know, what's interesting about this, and I've said from the beginning, the problem with our health care system, in addition to some, you know, the profit motive, is that we have all this patchwork. You've got Medicare, you've got Medicaid, you've got subsidies for low workers, you got all this stuff out there. If we were to stop with the Band-Aids and come up with a plan, you know, an idea, a way of doing things, I think we would be much better off.
You mean like the rest of the industrialized world, in other words?
The rest of the industrialized world. And what's interesting is we hear our Tea Party friends saying, oh, we don't want to be a socialist country. Like the last guy just said, we don't want to be socialist. Well, Americans generally underestimate the degree of income inequality in the United States and, if given a choice, would distribute wealth in a similar way to social democracies of Scandinavia, according to this new study. For decades, polls have shown the plurality of Americans, around 40%, consider themselves conservative, while only around 20% self-identify as liberals. But a new study from two noted economists cast doubt on what values lie behind those political labels. And I love this because this is good stuff. According to research carried out by Michael Norton of Harvard Business School and Dan Airy of Duke University, flagged by Paul Kendrowski at the Infectious Disease Greed blog, 92%, this is an amazing statistic, 92% of Americans would choose to live in a society with far less income disparity than the U.S., choosing Sweden's model over that of the U.S. What's more, they write, the study says that this applies to people of all income levels and all political leanings. So it's basically everybody, the rich, the poor, Democrats, Republicans, all of them are equally likely to choose the Swedish model. And we got to get these guys on here to talk about this. The article goes on to say the study also found that respondents preferred the Swedish model over a model of perfect income equality. So they didn't want perfect equality, but they wanted more equality. You know, not like we hear our friends on the right say, well, what you guys want, you want everybody to have the exact same thing. And no, we don't. But we'd like people to be a little closer. I don't want to be walking down the street like I do sometimes and have people with their hand out or, you know, people who you know are really struggling. I don't think that's good for a society. The article goes on to say recent analysis have shown that income inequality in the U.S. has grown steadily for the past three decades and reached its highest level on record, exceeding that of even the Great Depression and in the 20s before the Great Depression. Norton and Early estimate that 1%, the top 1%, control 50% of the country's wealth. 1%. While the richest 20% hold 84% of the wealth. And what's interesting is they asked the question to all of their respondents. They said, you know, what do you think the top 20% controls? And what would have a reasonable answer been if someone were to ask you that?
The top 20%?
Yeah.
40%.
Well, the answer was 84, but most people said 59%. Nobody came near the 84%. And when they were asked to choose how much the top 20% should have, the average response was amazingly 32%.
Oh, I thought that's what you were asking, what they should have had.
Oh, okay.
Oh, I know, it's much higher then.
What's most striking about the results, argue the authors, is that they show more consensus than disagreement among different demographic groups. All groups, even the wealthiest respondents, desired a more equal distribution of wealth than what they estimated the current U.S. levels to be, while all groups also desired some inequity, even the poorest responses. So, look, I mean, I keep hearing people, hey, we don't want no redistribution of wealth. I think the numbers are kind of laying that out, that that's not entirely true. The authors suggest the reason that American voters have not made more of an issue of the growing income gap is that they may simply not be aware of it.
Yes.
Second, just as people have erroneous beliefs about the actual level of wealth inequality, they may also hold overly optimistic beliefs about opportunities for social mobility in the United States. Beliefs which, in turn, may drive support for unequal distribution of wealth, they write. The authors also note that, though there may be widespread agreement about income inequality, there is no agreement on what caused it or what should be done about it. I say you have a tax code that's, helps. You know, we're in a major crisis right now in this country. There's limited revenues coming in. There are 400 people on a billionaires list who have more than they could possibly spend. Asking them to help a little bit more, not a bad idea.
Well, let's even look at this state. I mean, this state constitution forbids a progressive tax structure, which we need badly. I mean, it's not just the federal government, and it's not just Pennsylvania. So a lot of states find themselves in the same predicament. Now, granted, some of that is because they're getting less money from the federal government, but some of it is because of inequitable tax system.
I got to be honest. I'm usually up on this stuff, but 84% in the hands of the top 20% to me just seems, wow.
Well, it tells me that most Americans have a pretty good grasp of what is fair and just. But you hit it on the head. They don't connect the two when they find out the exact. They don't know the numbers, how bad it is. And then they don't understand how that affects their lives and how negative it is in a true republic, democratic republic like we have. There's a real disconnect there, and that's the problem.
Yes, there is. Anyway, it's amazing to me. Let's take a quick break. We're gonna come back, wrap this up. We're right back after this.
Just make us be brave, make us play nice, let us be together tonight.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
That old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Workers in the late 1930s began exerting their recently guaranteed right to organize and join unions. Millions of workers flocked to join the labor organization of their choosing to collectively bargain for better wages, hours, and working conditions. Factory, mill, and mine owners, not eager to embrace the changes, fought vehemently to deny workers their rights. As company tactics grew more heavy-handed and brutal, the workers' organizing methods changed. Sit-down strikes became a way for workers to demand their rights and to force management to listen. With a wave of a handkerchief, the tip of a hat, workers would shut down their machines, lay down their hammer, and sit down. Workers at the Hershey Chocolate Factory in Hershey, Pennsylvania, seeking to reduce the 60-hour-long work week, decided to form a union. Initially, an agreement was reached, but as the economy took a downturn, the company willfully violated the agreement by laying off the most senior workers, those who just happened to be the most ardent union supporters. The workers voted to strike the very next day. At 11 a.m. on April 2nd, 1937, a red handkerchief was waved and the workers began their first sit-down strike in Pennsylvania's history. The company reacted by forming the Loyal Workers Club. These strikebreakers consisted of hired thugs from New York City and local farmers, dairy producers, and shopkeepers who were dependent on the factory. On April 6, Hershey organized a loyalty parade. After hours of rallying speeches, the lathered-up Loyal Workers Club mob found pipes and clubs that had been manufactured at the Hershey planing mill. The angry mob headed to the Hershey factory to throw their strikers out. Songs of solidarity sung by the striking workers could be heard from inside the factory as the angry mob burst into the plant, blocking the only exit the Loyal Workers Club, Loyal Owners, only to management and greed began pummeling the workers as they tried to escape. The assault left numerous workers bloody and beaten, many unconscious. Within days, Hershey reopened and recognized the renamed version of the Loyal Workers Club. In May of 1938, the National Labor Relations Board ruled Hershey had violated the law and the company union was dissolved. Soon, the workers joined the Bakery and Confectionery Workers Local 464, who have faithfully represented the workers ever since. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Interesting story that the Hill reported. They're saying that Senate Democrats struck a deal Wednesday night with Republicans to keep President Obama from making recess appointments. It's another one of those things that just drives me nuts about Democrats. They're gonna strike this kind of deal that Republicans would have never made in a million years when Bush was in power. Never in a million years. But you know, the Democrats, yeah, well, we gotta show just how spineless we can be sometimes. Democratic leaders have agreed to schedule pro forma sessions of the Senate every week over the next 6 weeks, a move that will prevent President Obama from making emergency appointments, according to a Senate source. You know, here's my problem with this. We have got so many people that need to get into the government. There are so many appointments that have been blocked and obstructed and delayed and put and filibustered that at some point the president has to be able to say, look, I need the government to function. I need our government working. I need people in these posts. I got to appoint them.
Haven't we sung this song before? They went, the Republicans, I believe it was last year, went ballistic when he tried to make some appointments during recess. And then we look at the record, and Bush, oh my, did it. He did it repeatedly. You know, I agree with you on that issue, Rick. And then you wonder why people are dissatisfied with the accomplishments of the administration.
Look, if there's one or two people that you're really opposed to, I understand that. I mean, there are some people that you could say, you know, they're toxic. We really need to hold them out. I understand that. But the president has more than 110 executive and judicial branch nominees pending on the Senate's calendar that the Republicans are holding up. And to me, that is just plain wrong. And you look at the fact that some of the people that they've held up for several months, then once they decided that, okay, we're gonna stop delaying, we're going to stop stalling, we're going to stop gridlock, got votes of 99 to nothing and 98 to nothing. I mean, I understand, hey, if you've got a real ideological problem with somebody and you hold on, you delay, you do what you have to do, and then when you come up for a vote, you vote against them. I understand that, Jake.
Well, and here's another thing. If behind the scenes the administration says to the Republicans, okay, I'll agree not to appoint anybody, but I want this, this, and this. The Republicans don't seem to be giving this administration anything. And we know, we all know behind the scenes, let's be honest, there's agreements made between the leadership, there's agreements made between parties in the White House all the time, but where's the compromise on the Republican side? I don't see it.
Well, I mean, look, you know, there was a new poll that just came out that said, you know, they don't want people compromising. You know, we don't want compromise anymore.
It's not about compromise. It's about making government at least relatively effective.
We want.
Well, there again, the Republicans don't want it relatively effective. They want it ineffective.
Well, that plays into their mean. I mean, it plays into what they've been telling us. I don't believe in government. Well, no surprise when it failed.
Well, I got this one story, and it aggravates me when you look at what happened. There's a report coming out of Indiana. There's a company called J.D. Norman Industries. They recently dropped a bid for an Indianapolis General Motors plant. And the situation was that they wanted to buy a General Motors plant. But to do that, they went to the workers and said, okay, we need to drop your average wage from about $25 an hour to $15.50. The state was going to come in and offer some incentives to the company, and the whole arrangement was going to add, in addition to the about 600 employees, another 1,200. Now, the state came out after the vote was pretty unanimous, not unanimous, but they rejected the bid. And the state spokesman came out and said, you know, he was really nasty about it. He said they've turned their back on the future generations of people who might have had their jobs in Indiana. Then you go and you listen to the UAW spokesman. He said, look, they not only wanted deep cuts in wages, they wanted to take away most of what we fought for years. So this company wanted to expand, but the workers basically had to give up most of what they fought for the last couple of decades. It's ridiculous.
What were the workers going to get in return? Were they going to get
out
stock
of jobs.
In the company? Were they going to get stock in the company? So if the company
say.
Did well, that they would
say.
Do well? Of course not.
Probably not.
How many of those people, if they took the $10 an hour pay cut, how many of those people would then lose their homes because they can't afford to make their payments?
Exactly, there's
a lot to this.
Well, now, I mean, to the benefit of some of the workers that voted no, depending on their situation, according to the article, some of them had the option of going to other GM plants. So it wasn't like a no vote would have eliminated their jobs. Some of them still have jobs. And I can't blame them. You're asking workers to take about a 40-45% cut in wages? Why? So the company can prosper? And I'd like to know what sacrifice the company make?
Well, they gave you the $15 an hour.
I
can understand saying, hey, look, we need to free up some money. We're going to buy this place. We're going to give you stock. We're going to break it up, and we're going to give you stock in the company. I can see there being an argument for that. But we're taking it, and shame on you. Yeah. I mean, this is another example of why it's important to have a union, why
Absolutely.
It's important to have a contract. If these were non-union workers, do you think we'd be hearing about it? No, it would be done.
Well, they talk about economic development and saving jobs. Here the state, I mean, I say only $2 million is $2 million. But in the context of the number of jobs and the size of this deal, the state only offered $2 million. Start doing the numbers of the sacrifice of these workers. I mean, right now you have over 600 that are going to be sacrificing $10, $11, $12 per hour. Where's the equity? Where's the fairness? But that's our culture right now. And of course they blame the workers. I don't blame them. I would have voted no on that too.
I would have as well. I mean, the company that I worked for, they're going to freeze the pension for another. They freeze it's been frozen for 18 months. They're looking at freezing it for another 6 months and then contributing at a very small rate from then on.
And it doesn't say anything about the sacrifices of management, which was probably zero.
Well, I'm sure if they would have taken the pay cut, the CEO would have gotten a nice big fat bonus.
Absolutely. And I'm sure that was part of the mindset of the workers. Can't blame them.
No, I mean, you know, look, I understand sacrifice. I do. You know, but the reality is, if the sacrifice is felt only on one side of the equation, don't be surprised when that one side, you know, stands up and says no. And I look at what's going on down in Philly with these Express Script people. The company's profitable. They've made a half a billion dollars profit this year alone. And they're saying, well, you know, we're going to make some health care cuts. We're going to make some wage cuts because we want more. We want to suck more blood out of the rock. And, you know, again, you know, if it's not for having a contract, this stuff just happens. There's no discussion. There's no fighting about it. It just happens. And this is what I think, if you take anything away from this program tonight, one, health care in this country seriously needed to be reformed. And this president took the bull by the horns, maybe not in the way I would have liked, But he accomplished something, and we're going to be moving forward. And the other part of it is, look, if you don't have a contract, you don't have anything. You know, every CEO I've ever heard of, they've had a contract, which is why when they get fired, they walk out the door like the guy who was the head of Home Depot, $210 million to get fired. I've never been fired from a job where they hand me a check on the way out the door. Usually they say, get out. And that's what I get. I don't get a nice big boat, a nice big poster-sized car to check. I get a kick in the behind.
You know, all the time you get fired, they never gave you a bonus on the way out the door.
No.
Imagine that.
I got a bonus when I came back in, though.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, another great night. Thanks to our guests, State Rep Dave Ledansky and Liz Schuler, Secretary-Treasurer of the AFL-CIO. We'll see you tomorrow night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at The Rick Smith Show.